Thank you, Billy. Ms. Miller, let's take the roll.
Commissioner Amanzada. Commissioner Bochco.
Here.
Here.
Commissioner Bochco.
Here.
Commissioner Brownsey.
Here.
Commissioner Escalante.
Here.
Commissioner Gold. Here. Commissioner Groom.
Present.
Commissioner Hart.
Present.
Commissioner Howell.
Here.
Commissioner Ketchum.
Here.
Commissioner Rice.
Here.
Commissioner Turnbull Sanders.
Here.
Commissioner Uranga.
Present.
Commissioner Wilson. Chair Padilla.
Present. Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Swing, agenda changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to the Commission and to everybody in the audience today. I do want to be sure that anybody who plans on speaking to the Commission today to please fill out a speaker slip and hand that in to a staff member. Speaker slips are available at the table at the entry to this room. Also want to ask you to please silence your mobile devices while you're in the meeting room so that you don't disturb the meeting. As far as agenda changes, we're adding this morning item 10A. This is permit amendment 118-1078A1. This is for the Caltrans Eureka Arcata 101 corridor project. That's moved to consent. Items 13A and 14A, this is applications 919-880 and consistency certification 4-19. These are for the subsea fiber optic cable in Hermosa Beach. That's moved to consent. Item 13B, it's application 919-858. California Resources Corporation for Ventura, that's moved to consent. Item 17A, this is the City of Encinitas LCP amendment on their emergency shelters. This is the certification review. That's moved to consent. Item 17B, again, City of Encinitas LCP amendment. This is regarding minor subdivisions and lot line adjustments. That's moved to consent. Item 17C, City of San Diego's LCP amendment, certification review on placemaking. That's moved to consent. Item 18A, this is Appeal A6, LJS 19198. This is a San Diego Children's Pool retaining wall. That matter is postponed. Item 19A, it's application 619-731, City of San Diego Public Works Department, Dog Beach Improvements Project. That's moved to consent. Item 19B, it's application 619-998. The Ocean Ranch Estates project in Solana Beach, that's postponed. And item 20A, this is permit amendment 616-406A2 for Lowe's Coronado Bay Resort in California State Parks in Coronado. This is moved to consent. And that concludes the agenda changes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swing. We will move to public comment. This is an opportunity for anyone to address the commission on an item that is not on the agenda. When I call your name, please come forward to the podium. This podium is not all that sensitive, so get a little close to it if you can so everyone can hear you. State your name for the record, and your time will be limited to 3 minutes. Understand that Caltrans reps are here. I'm going to take Caltrans first. Jeff Pimentel. Good morning. Welcome. I understand that Rob Mead and Robert Wall are ceding time to you.
Yes, I shouldn't need much more than 3 minutes, but just
for the total, or are probably, each of you speaking, or are you speaking?
No, I am the only one speaking. During
all right,
public
great.
Comment.
Thank you so much.
9 minutes.
Yeah. And then there's a presentation. Also, he's loading.
All right.
All right. So my name is Jeff Pimentel. I'm a project manager with Caltrans in District 1 on the North Coast. Back in August, during the North Coast meeting, we had our coast development permit for discussion at that meeting. This is really, since we're here on other items on the agenda, we decided that we'd give a brief update on where we are with the sea level rise condition as part of that project. I understand in October there'll be another North Coast meeting, and we plan to have a more comprehensive update to provide you at that time. any direction I'm supposed to. Okay, I see it. Is that better? Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so as part of the condition, there are a baseline report and annual reports, as well as the comprehensive adaptation implementation plan. By May 1st of this year, we are on schedule to deliver the baseline report as well as begin the annual report submissions. Also part of the condition was to do photo logging of the king tides from various points around Humboldt Bay, and we've completed two rounds of those photo logs. And then the comprehensive adaptation implementation plan due by 2025 or sooner based on certain triggers in the condition. We've begun outlining what that plan will look like, and we've shared that with local coastal staff back in December, and we continue to work and finalize that outline. We did work with local coastal staff to get consensus on where the photo logging locations will be. Here they are, and there's a buy-off on both parties for that. These are just a couple sample photos that were taken. The first one in the top left is a baseline high tide photo from December 23rd of last year, and then in comparison to the same location during the first of the two events we logged on January 10th of this year. Also, as part of the condition, we are employing some staffing changes to help deliver on this condition. One of those being on the more long-range planning side of the house. So we'll be bringing on a climate change adaptation branch chief will be their official title. And then in contrast to that, with regards to actual project delivery for projects that are moving through project development and further along, we'll be bringing on another North Region coastal liaison with a focus on sea level rise adaptation in current projects. And we plan to have both those staff members on board by spring of 2020. And so that wraps it up. And as I mentioned, we'll be back in October to give you a more comprehensive update. Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate the update very much. Are there questions regarding the update, by the way, before we? All right. Just checking. Natalie Hernandez? Is Natalie here? Okay. Okay. I have a slip for item for public comment, so you don't want to speak under public comment?
She ceded her time.
Oh, excuse me. To. Okay, and let me see if I have a. Forgive me. If I have a speak for Anna. Here we go. So, not only Natalie, but Phil Geisen is also ceding time. Okay, and I'll call on you. Come on up. Sorry about that. Welcome. Your time is limited to 9 minutes.
Yes. First of all, happy Valentine's Day on Tongva and Ahashiman shared territory here in Long Beach. And I have a PowerPoint from the Long Beach Area Peace Network. Start my time. Oh, God, I can't look at myself there. That's terrifying. Equity is at the heart of the Coastal Act, California Coastal Commission's Environmental Justice Policy 2019. Coastal development should be inclusive for all who work, live, and recreate on California's coast and provide equitable benefits for communities that have historically been excluded, marginalized, or harmed by coastal development. I press this. Oh, darn it. Now I don't even know how to do this. Forward. Oh, there we go. Everybody in the pool. Labopin believes that healthy communities prioritize public health, safety, and recreation and act accordingly. As a coastal city, Long Beach must ensure that our residents become and stay water safe by providing swimming lessons and aquatic exercise to the 99%. Equal access is neither the history of nor the status quo in the LBC. Until the 1950s, minorities could not rent or buy property in most of the city. At the Pike, the Plunge was legally segregated, and the Midway included racist games such as the African Dip Game, which was played up until the 1950s over protests of our African, very brave and bold African-American citizens. De facto segregation ensured that the city's beaches were for whites only. In 128-year history, the city has only funded 3 public pools. How and where we put them reveals a pattern of race and class privilege. Won't read all the details. The top one is the Belmont Olympic Pool, built in a wealthy white neighborhood, and the other two, the Silverado, Martin Luther King, Jeff Wiltse, in his book Contested Waters, would refer to them as Jim Crow pools in communities of color. Now, Belmont Pool got torn down. The city wants to build the Belmont Beach and Aquatic Center, 2 Olympic pools, a recreational pool, teaching pool, 40-foot-high dive tower, diving tank, spa, bleachers, seating 1,500. Its proposed location and design are both physical and social barriers for Long Beach's most marginalized residents. The coastal environmental justice policy calls for a fundamental rethinking of who is connected to the coast, or maybe not. That's a sports team that swims in the Belmont Pool, a club. The city insists that the new BAC remain in the same locations as the demolished Belmont Olympic Pool and that it prioritize existing users, that's in the EIR, including private swim and dive clubs and sports teams. This fails to provide equitable benefits for communities that have historically been excluded or marginalized and denies public access to and low-cost recreation to all. Here's our city. You've been here a couple of days now. It's very big. It's the 7th largest city. It's not a coastal town in California, 7th largest, 500,000 residents, 9 council districts. We're down here in the 3rd, the green area towards the about halfway across. That's where the pool is going to be. Only area to hold community meetings. Kind of hard to read, but the dark blue or the darkest blue, those are the white people. And you can see that, you know, east side where the pool is, 99 mostly white, and everybody else downtown or north. Here's our population density. Is this pool really going to serve more people where it's located? It's in the lightest population density. The darkest in the yellow, you know, not on the east side. And here's the poverty rate. So you can see these are graphs. This is a public state graph. You can look it up. I didn't make it up. Better water safe than sorry. You may or may not know, 4,000 people die every year from drowning, 10 every day, 2 are children. And those are the statistics that got me on this roll. How come kids aren't learning to swim? I was horrified when I read these. And that's why LaBopin is focusing on environmental justice. You will read other appeals that have to do, and we support them, that have to do with sea rise and the environment and the birds and everything. But this is about our kids and our communities. So black youth, 10 times more likely to drown than whites. So LaBopin says move it or lose it. We really are in favor of community pools first. We believe that that should be the priority for our city in every council district. But just at the very least, move it and change it from the way it was designed as a competitive facility to something that serves our community. What does the city say? We'll put in a zip line. We'll put in more parking for bicycles. That doesn't make it equitable, and it doesn't help our kids learn to swim. Ensure access to public pools and swimming instruction for all with the goals of our own healthy communities policy, which says we will build new recreational facilities in underserved districts. We have an overserved area. Build and maintain a community pool in every city council district. We do have community support. Councilman Richardson in the 9th wants a community pool. He supports it. Our citizens, we've done polls, we've done surveys. Everybody wants community pools. That's the best way to teach kids to swim. Make it within walking distance, biking distance. Long Beach School Superintendent for the 9th District says 2 hours. It takes kids 2 hours to get to this pool. She's even started junior lifeguard training just so that they can possibly qualify to be in the program out at Jordan High in the 9th District. Because our junior lifeguard program, our lifeguards, this is about careers too, but that's not your problem. Your problem is the beach. Increased diversity and citywide participation in public aquatics programs for youth, including swimming lessons, water sports, sailing and boating, junior lifeguard and aquatic day camps. So I just want to say that when it's your job to approve a local coastal plan and the local, this coastal development permit for this pool. And when you look at how the city addresses environmental justice, I think you might have some concerns because their offering at their last city council meeting was that they're going to have a bus pull up out in the 9th district at Jordan High, and once a week they're going to load kids who are in the park program there onto the bus and give them a ride to the pool for rec time. But what if you don't swim? And since I have a couple more minutes, I'd just like you to maybe, I'm not going to say to close your eyes, that's too touchy-feely, but just imagine that you get to the beach, and you're at the beach anywhere in California, and maybe you got a cheap motel, because I know you guys are fighting for those, and maybe you got a squeezed in between those wealthy people's houses up in Malibu, right? And now you're standing on the beach. Imagine you can swim, even surf, right? You jump in, but imagine you can't. You cling to your mom, maybe, if you're a kid. Or if you're a mom, you can't swim, you fear for your children. And this is what's happening all up and down the coast. Whether it's the Leeway Sailing Program in Long Beach, that when it offers free days to the inner city kids, a lot of them stay home. If you can't swim, your children are less likely to swim. We have a historic exclusion of minorities, especially minorities. And that's why we have less minorities at our beaches. It's good to offer low-cost motels. It's good to get people out onto the sand. But let's get people in the water. Please help us. Don't have our city. Because if we spend $80 million on this pool in East Long Beach, on the beach, we will not build another one downtown. That's for darn sure. And we appreciate very much, last call out, shout out to the staff for asking the city to consider a site outside of the coastal zone for this project, because it is not a coastal related project. You can build a swimming pool away from the beach. So thanks very much.
Oh, I can't believe Thank you. Yes, Commissioner Hart.
Thank you so much for those comments. And I just wanted to say, in Sonoma County, Regional Parks funds a program called Vamos a Nadar, because there's a river, the Russian River, that runs through Sonoma County, and there's a lot of drownings, and it's horrible, and it's largely in the communities that you've just defined. So what I was wondering to our staff, with the whale tail grants that we're going to be discussing later today, do the whale tail grants, could those extend to swimming programs for low-income kids or kids from environmental justice communities? And if so, it would be a great way to expand that program.
Yes, if there's an educational component to that, which there is, swimming, I think that would qualify, absolutely.
That's something to make people aware of broadly, that they
Thank
should apply
you.
For those grants.
Yeah, the USA Swimming has a program, Splash, and it does that. And so our issue is location, location, location. And also I'd highly recommend... We did give Ms. Turnbull-Sanders a copy of Jeff Wiltsey's book, Contested Waters. I highly recommend it, on the history of swimming and pools in America. It's really amazing, and there has always been race and class privilege. And so, hello, anybody, if you know what I mean.
Commissioner Hart, that's a great idea. Commissioner Turnbull-Sanders?
Yes, I'd just like to thank the member of the public who just, Ms. Christensen, for bringing this relation between environmental justice and swimming together. This is something we've been talking about at the commission for at least like the last, 6 to 10 years, around how do we reduce the barriers to access, and it's not always kind of a physical barrier. And so I just would encourage the staff to continue to expand this idea of environmental justice and think about access in terms of being able to provide resources to teach kids how to swim. I swam at the old Belmont Shore pool, so this is bringing back some nostalgia. I was a competitive swimmer, but I think more programs need to be focused on these things, and I appreciate staff's inclusion in the strategic plan of recognition that more organizations, not just the traditional environmental organizations, need to be brought into the fold with respect to our public education grant-making process.
Thanks. Thanks, commissioners. Next, I will call on Robin Rudisell, followed by Eva Green. Morning.
Robin Rudisil, good morning. Many of you know that we lost a longtime Venetian last week, Mr. Orson Bean, a true icon of our Venice character and culture. I've distributed copies of the Argonaut newspaper so you can read about this amazing man, his love for the Venice canals and of Venice, and his extreme generosity. The outpouring from our community has been overwhelming. We'll miss him very much, and our hearts and prayers go out to his wife, Allie Bean, and the rest of his family. I'm here today again because I want to brief you on a project being evaluated at the City of LA. The project is to convert open space zoning adjacent to the Grand Canal, just one block from the beach and the center of the Venice Boardwalk tourist area, in dual permit jurisdiction area, currently critical visitor parking, and the zoning change is to community commercial zoning for affordable and permanent supportive housing and commercial use. The site, called the Venice Median, is a significant area of our open space in the Venice Coastal Zone, and once rezoned, it's gone forever. Knowing I would be here today, Orson Bean's wife, Allie, asked me to share the following with you in his honor. After 56 years in Venice, Orson was dismayed at the lack of our city's support to protect our Venice neighborhood's unique history and open space. He personally found this Venice Median project a potential beginning of the end of Venice as we know it. He saw its value that so many foreigners and nationals come to witness, unique, a little crazy, and full of all kinds of folks from all economic backgrounds and cultures. His wish was that Venice never lose its history or its open space. This would be by far the largest scale project ever in Venice. There are many other locations for this housing that must be considered before completely wiping out a finite resource such as open space near the beach, adjacent to the canals, and at one of the most heavily visited tourist locations in California. The parking deficit for visitors and residents is one of the most important Venice coastal issues, and there are no substitutes for the Venice Median for purposes of addressing this significant and growing parking deficit. The beachfront parking lots cannot be expanded by law. Thus, the Venice Median is the only place we have where we can expand our parking. In fact, the Venice Coastal Parking Impact Trust Fund, where the in-lieu parking fees have been paid over the years, is to be used to increase available parking in the beach impact zone, specifically for improvements at this very location, the Venice Boulevard Median Public Parking Facility. The LA City Council made a big mistake in identifying the Venice Median for this project, and many believe the City Council was misinformed in making that decision. Also, there was no public process prior to the city identifying this site. This project requires a general plan amendment and a certified land use plan amendment to approve this very significant zone change to permanently eliminate this significant area of open space. The project violates numerous Coastal Act and certified land use plan provisions, and the Coastal Act does not allow increases in density in flood hazard areas, which this is. This elimination of open space should be a non-starter for many reasons.
Thank you, Robin, and our condolences on Orson's passing. Eva Green.
Hi. Yes, I said, I'm Eva Green. I want to say that there are two simultaneous things taking place with the Venice Median that Robin was talking about and in Venice in general. One is the hazards of climate change affecting our coastline. Venice is in a sea level rise, tsunami, and flood zone in the lowest lying area of the Santa Monica Bay. In December 2019, the Legislative Analyst Office report said that the strongest approach for minimizing hazards is to avoid siting new development within the areas vulnerable to flooding, inundation, and erosion. Section 30253 of the Coastal Act requires new development to minimize risk to life and property in areas with these problems. Even a modest amount of sea level rise could overwhelm communities, and failure to act will result in much higher costs much later. Your own Jack Ainsworth said this sort of science is absolutely critical to our planning and that we really need to work with a sense of urgency. Yet our city officials are pushing to build homeless housing at five sites in Venice, all west of Lincoln. Our District 11 councilman knows the hazards of climate change because in an LA Times article in 2018, he said his beach communities will be underwater in the next 50 years. Yet he still wants to build this housing in a designated flood and tsunami zone, and it's not making sense because there are many alternatives. It's also not making sense why the city wants to turn this visitor's destination into a homeless hub with potential developments at the Venice Median, Metro Lot, Thatcher Yard, Rose Avenue Apartments, and the Lincoln Apartments. This brings me to the second issue. Venice is a tourist destination, and it must be respected as such. Tourist destinations are unlike most areas of the city. Venice is only second to Disneyland in number of visitors. And we cannot turn LA's most popular tourist destination into a homeless hub when people come here for pleasure and recreation. Also, compared to Disneyland, Venice Beach parking is a pittance in comparison. Lack of crucial parking is an impediment to beach access. It is a barrier to beach access, in fact. LA City is seeking short-term solutions to housing, and it will have real long-term consequences if these developments are built. Crucial parking can never be expanded once these developments go in. Sea level rise, climate change are real, but LA City has taken these effects not very seriously. If the five developments are built, sea level rise will flood the city's investment and harm our most vulnerable, the homeless and the mentally ill. Given the negatives I've discussed, would you approve this if it was a standard commercial development? Because there are many alternatives. 7,500 city-owned vacant lots and buildings. Building or rehabbing east of Lincoln, still in Venice, and not placing homeless in harm's way. Rehabbing is quicker, more areas of high, rather than the areas of high geological and flood hazards. It's a good thing to heed the warnings of Manager Treat, as advised by the Legislative Analyst Office and the Coastal Act, to require new developments to minimize risks of life and property in high areas of geological and flood hazards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Judith Davies? And just a clarification, Ms. Davies, is there one or two people ceding time to you? All right, then that would be Kathy Knight and Patricia McPherson. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, welcome. 9 minutes.
Thank you. I have a two-part presentation, but the one that I'd be presenting now is not on one. Is not one of the items of your strategic plan and the sea level rise and so on. So I'd like to present just this one. Can you see? Oh, sorry. Okay. Yes, this is part of a larger presentation that I also want to present toward your sea level rise. I think it's 5.1 issue today. Yes.
Comes up and not presented here?
This does not
something
regard
completely
that.
Separate?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
So you're
but
just
it was
using
part
the same
presentation,
set of info
so I'm kind of like reading a section of something that is kind of truncated. However, I am here as a member of the executive committee of the Airport Marina Group of the Sierra Club, and we're particularly concerned with the Biona Wetlands Ecological Reserve and the final EIR that has been recently issued by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. My issue here, one of the many, has to do with the very important serious problem regarding the Tongva sacred site. And what the first slide here is actually showing several things here, but it's a T-sheet from the 1800s, and you can first see that the Biona Wetlands is largely closed off. It's largely separated by sand dunes and so on and closed off from the ocean. And fresh waters are quite prevalent there in the 1800s. Let's see, next slide. And it does relate to this archaeological portion of an archaeological set of maps that shows the progressive closing off of the Biona area at large from the 8,000 before present up to 200 before present. And the final illustration there on the lower right-hand side is very similar to what you saw on the previous slide in the 1800s, and this is listed as being 200 before present. So we're about at that same time period as well. So you can see it's largely closed off from full tidal. And so that's one issue that kind of spills over. This is sort of a bad pun. But so the issue with the sacred site has been registered under by John Tommy Rosas, who is a Tongva member, and he He submitted the registration in 2003 for several areas in the whole area of the lower part of the Bayona wetlands, which is now the ecological reserve. So that was submitted to the Native American Heritage Commission, and I think that was submitted as well to you in a previous presentation in March of last year. Next slide. And the next slide. Yes, this is a copy of, sorry, it's overlaid, but the vertical one is the copy of the official submission and registration with the Native American Heritage Commission back in 2003. Okay, then we go to the next slide. There are two following photographs that were presented also in that presentation previously of the way the 1500 burials were treated at that time, digging up and then having them wash away, basically. So we could go to the next slide, too. So this is a very more than troubling. It's really upsetting to have witnessed this. I was there at the time when all this was going on. I was as a volunteer videotaping, and I also, as a teacher, was doing a year-long educational program to inform and educate various students in four different schools, including Loyola and Venice High School and so on. And so I was very involved at that time when this was all going on. And so one of the issues is that the Playa Vista, this was being built during Playa Vista, and the ongoing proposals for these plans upcoming for digging out and creating these large berms and so on and full tidal coming in are also kind of being presented and represented through the long arm of the Playa Capitol and Playa Vista as well. So it really disturbs me that these are possibilities that the upcoming plan might involve digging out sites, archaeological sites. Some of these go back 8,000 years that were at this time dug up and removed. So we could look at the next slide. This is an oversight of the... I'm missing a slide. Anyway, this is an oversight, a view of the gas facilities, the SoCal underground storage facilities that overlook... I took the picture from the bluffs up above. This is just one other kind of complication there with the dig out. But this is a view of the plains or the area that should be preserved as a sacred site, because as we know, over people have been settled here for well over 10,000 years and out into the island. So if they're going to be digging 25 feet down, they're going to be digging into most likely other areas and other levels of settlements that we don't even know about. And it's going to be, I won't say going, because I really think that this shouldn't happen and won't happen. And I thank you for your including in your strategic plan the sections on tribal relations. As I said, the same entities are involved here as well, coming up, and this travesty must not be repeated. It's public land, not private land. Not that that matters, but Capitol had its say with what to do with the archaeology, and they paid for the archaeology there as well and got reimbursed by Belarus funds for all that. They say they paid, but they actually got reimbursed. I was there sitting at the at the table when that decision was made. This travesty must not be repeated. It's public land, it's public trust, and this aspect of legal rights for Native Americans must be addressed. I'm happy to see that there is a set of several goals regarding tribal relations, and I strongly urge that the Commission develop those ties and legal strengths, and it would be great if the Native Americans could be represented on staff as well to accomplish these goals. It would make total sense to me to have the area of the Biona Wetlands Ecological Reserve be designated as a World Heritage Site. The people who came here, lived here, and on the islands date back farther than 10,000 years. These are thought to be some of the oldest settlements on this continent, and surely important to world history for everyone. This is a very fundamental reason not to dig up the wetlands. The archaeological sites that were found already date back from 8,500 before present to the mission period. That's already in the Playa Vista area. These are sites that were found in Playa Vista, but the wetlands farther to the west would surely hold more and much deeper in the sediments. The bulldozing and digging down as much as 25 feet would surely destroy other ancient sites. Scientists have reasoned that because of sediment buildup as well as ocean rising over thousands of years, we can only say these areas are so important for the history of us all. That's why we should fight to have it listed not only by the state of California, but as a National Heritage Site and more appropriately a World Heritage Site.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Krista Gostenhofer? Welcome.
Thank you. I am speaking on the San Onofre decommissioning permit that you all approved last October. And I felt obligated to myself to come and let you know that you were misled in information that was the basis of your passing the permit. It was assumed that, let me follow my notes here. Basically, you were told by Mr. Palmisano of Edison that these canisters are inspectable and transportable. And that was a basic assumption. Everyone wants this stuff off the beach. But in reality, these canisters are not inspectable. The NRC senior inspector in FOIA documents that we received clearly states that according to ASME code, they're not inspectable and they are not repairable. Edison's own visual assessment report says that it's not an official inspection. These are documents you can look up. They were submitted to you before you passed that permit. You have an aging management requirement that Edison submit to you in March. Well, the canisters, let's see, I'm losing my thought. Aging management, according to the NRC, requires the ability to inspect for cracks or canister degradation, and it requires the ability to either repair the canisters or take them out of service. This is not possible with these canisters. And we have corrosion issues, concerns, and now with the damage that's happened during the downloading, which Edison claims they can inspect, but they didn't, you know, anyway. That also has introduced carbon particles to the canisters, which has introduced a whole other area of canister degradation and acceleration. So the issue of transporting these canisters off-site is something that you really ought to acknowledge is not an option. And one of the other reasons you approved the permit was to create a space for on-site relocation of the ISFACI. Well, Edison proposed 5 sites for that ISFACI. So I really recommend you reevaluate this permit approval and really look at the your jurisdiction, which is transportability, and enforce that. If these canisters are not transportable, then your whole permit approval was based on a false premise. We also have the Areva canisters that are looking at 17 years old already. We don't know the condition of those.
Diane Hayek.
I just wanted to, it's Valentine's Day.
You're very kind, thank you. No, thank you. But thank you for your goodwill. I can't eat the sugar, but I'll share it. Thank you. Lollipops and roses. Yeah, that's the theme of the day. All right. Thank you so much for the kind gesture. Diane Hayek. Thank you, Anthony. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Diane Hayek, and I live in Santa Monica, California. I am here to speak about vacation short-term rentals, wanting it to be legal in Santa Monica. The city of Santa Monica only wants to allow home sharing where the owner, host, has to live there with the vacationer. To me, this does not address affordable housing for families with children or friends that want to travel with other friends. Most home sharing places are two bedrooms, where the host would sleep in one of the bedrooms and the vacation person or persons would sleep in the other. It is good for a single person or a couple. That's it. What about making affordable accommodations for families and people that want to travel with friends? People all over the world want to come visit Santa Monica. This is one of the main places that people think of when they come to vacation in Southern California. My sister and I own several condos right on Ocean Avenue, steps from the beach, perfect location for vacationers. We rented half of our condos to long-term tenants and the other half to vacation rentals. We have been doing this for over 15 years, if not longer. Our prices range less than half, if not one-fourth, of the hotels in the surrounding areas. Hotels are $550 to $650 and up a night for a studio with no kitchen. We provided studios, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, all with kitchens. Our prices range from $90 to $225 a night. We've had so many happy vacationers, people that could not afford going to a hotel came to stay at our condos until the city stopped us. I get so many calls now from people who want to come back only to have to turn them away. I would like to think whether should you decide to do short-term rentals in Santa Monica, it is my hope that you will also consider grandfathering properties that have been doing it for years, way before Airbnb came into the picture. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. John Hayek? Jean, excuse me.
Good morning. My name is Jean Hayek, and I live in California. The cities of Santa Monica and Los Angeles have passed ordinances severely limiting, if not totally prohibiting, short-term rentals in the coastal zone. This eliminates opportunities for families and low-income people to stay overnight on our coast. Unlike many other cities who cooperate with and respect the Commission, Santa Monica and Los Angeles ignore the Commission and pass these restrictive ordinances, assuming the Commission will not do anything about it. Only the Commission speaks for the many inland Californians who now have no alternative but expensive hotels in Santa Monica and very few rooms in Venice. Please enforce the Coastal Act. Provide opportunities for those not rich enough or lucky enough to live along the coast. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea Leon Grossman. Morning.
Good morning. My name is Andrea Leon Grossman. I'm representing Azul, and you should all have received this card. As part of Azul's mission is to increment the access to the ocean and the coast. So one of the things that we did last year was design a card that will inform especially Latinx community of their rights when they go to the coast. Many of our community members are still harassed when they go to the coast and they're told that it's a private beach. So we decided to make sure that they know what their rights are. This card basically says what their rights are, and if you open it, they have some common myths and some tactics that some property owners use in terms of using fake greenery or other obstacles so that they think people, members of the public will think that that's a private property and access is basically impeded. So we want to make sure that they know what the rights are. The other thing that we have here is a chart and a diagram about what part of the sand is public and what part is private. And we know and we're fully aware that with sea level rise, this might change, especially as the wet sand approaches the homes. So we know that, you know, eventually we'll have to change this. And finally, on the back, we do have a little call-out box in English so that if any of our Spanish-speaking members are harassed by an English speaker, they can just point out to that little call-out box saying, hey, you know, this is this matter, and please read this box, and we know our rights. So we really think that this is a good tool for our members to use, and they can report any abuse to us. We really think that access to the beach is a right, and we need to promote that right. I do want to echo some of the issues that we have heard before here, like the access to Bayona Wetland and other communities here. We need to fight industrialization of the coast. I think we have other means of having energy, and we need to make sure that you know, places like the gas storage facility and fighting pollution and segregating beaches like we have here in Southern California, we make sure that our communities are not just relegated to a few beaches, but they know that they have access to all beaches in California. So I appreciate you listening to me this morning, and happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And then Vice Chair Brownsey has a comment for you. Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, I think this is fabulous. And thank you to Azul for doing it. I just wanted to point out, if you do another reproduction of this card, we have Your Coast, which is an app that people can download for free, and they can just press on it, and then it'll tell them all kinds of information about the beaches in their area. And so it'll tell them when they're open and if they can bring a dog and what kind of activities are there. And so that may help anyone who wants to go to the beach, but certainly for families to know that parking's close by or what the amenities are. So I just offer that to you because I think this is a great way to outreach to the community. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioner Escalante.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
And thank you so much. I had seen this. Marcela had shared it, and I thought it was wonderful, and I hope that maybe you can, if you have some copies to spare that are, this is one of those things in the strategic plan and in terms of partnerships with groups that are doing such great work. If maybe on the, when we table at the meetings, you know, we could have a little stack there so that community members could take it when they come to the meetings. This is really an excellent idea, and we're really grateful for that. Gracias.
Yeah, I brought a few extra copies so I can leave them behind. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Thank you, Commissioner. Ted Zellmer. Mr. Zellmer here? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, forgive me. I forgot. I believe that Billy from AGP is going to put some information in the record for us and for the members of the public.
Commissioners, well, it's really strange being here.
Please speak into the mic, sir. We can't hear you.
Thank you. Is it on? Is it on? Testing, testing. The reason, if you're getting any hits saying that people cannot watch the broadcast, our server has been hacked with a ransomware virus, or our techs cannot get into it, and we are going to have to actually blow down the servers and rebuild them. So we will not be broadcasting live. We are recording the meeting. And as soon as we get our servers back online, we will push the video up, and everybody will be able to watch it post.
Thank you, Billy. That's one of those things. Thank you very much for that information. It's unfortunate. All right. Ted. And you have time being ceded to you by Mary Landru?
Landucci. Yes.
Landucci, excuse me. Your seating time? Okay.
Mary Landucci is our colleague with our organization, Limitless. I'd like to ask for 9 minutes if we can consider the big guy upstairs.
Yep, got to give you six. Okay. Got to do it in six. But welcome.
We have Alameda. Can I use the camera over here if it's okay? Thank you. We have Alameda Bay Marina, which will be threatened. Just as a review, I shared yesterday the first of the two catamarans my father built in 1951, Hermosa Beach. My brother being the regional rep in Florida for the catamaran Olympic sailing. Our team here in Long Beach. And the reason I came here initially was to propose alternative to the Belmont Pool is option number three, with a parking structure, Los Cerritos wetlands, and new skate park for the lifeguards on top of the parking structure on the beach at Cherry, which will be underwater. We're here to protect it with a seawall heading to Alameda Bay and another one downtown. Our intention would be to contact Edison right away to see what they have planned regarding all of this. Who we are, Limitless. We have these brand new boats that were just displayed at the LA Yacht Club at the boat show. We're bringing them to Long Beach and Los Angeles. That's for paralyzed veterans, students, kids, urban. The beauty of it is they hold two people, so we'll get the urban youth involved with their fellow disabled friends, which will be introducing them into the sport of sailing for the Olympics coming, skateboarding too. And to get them into the boat, we've designed, patented, and engineered a brand new hoist that's stable to be attached to the pilings as removable. The top cap gray sits over the piling. The hoist itself just clips on and off every day like a gate. It's stable. That's what it's used for, is to get them in and out in a nice, stable manner. This is the engineered plans for the hoist and patented. Then, real quickly, recently we had the Beachcomber News regarding our road diet here in Long Beach, which did not serve well with regards to City Planning Commission decision-making and expenditures. I'll disclose it now, but I took that photo from the bus, and that explains the problems with that. Then just recently, our partner Laker Larry was interviewed in the Beachcomber for the passing of Kobe Bryant. We have a lot of interest in the urban community to bring the kids down to the beach at Cherry, where our lifeguard headquarters is, and that's why we're proposing an option number three for the Belmont Pool at that location. We will be using the California ABCs of boating safety, Coast Guard manual, as we teach our students to both sail and swim. Our intention is to invite the urban youth in a manner to the beach that they already go to, being Cherry Beach, and creating a program that is interesting to them to even want to learn how to swim. Am I losing myself? Okay, here we go. This is all unrehearsed, last-minute drawings, last-minute thinking. We've been doing our research. We've gone ahead and patented this, that, and the other. But based on decisions that have been made by our city council and city planning commission recently, we've been concerned. The So what we have here is we had the Planning Commission approve the Broadway road diet. And if you'll all notice recently as you step outside, 2 months ago, Laker Larry, myself, and our colleague at the Beachcomber came down and took temperature readings. We had 93 degrees in the sun outside, 91 degrees in the shade of the Port Building, 92 degrees in the shade of the Port Building with the reflection of the sun. And when we stood in outside in the area with the sun and the reflection of the sun, 120 degrees. Some of you will notice you're starting to sweat out here if you got a suit and tie on. I learned this when I came to the grand opening. And so my concern is, as a retired general contractor, is that we need to have some good decision-making with that sort of general contracting approach. No one bothered to call the Epcot Center at Universal Studios regarding their clear glass structure that they had to change over because all the Burbank executives were complaining regarding all the reflection of the glass in their offices and what have you. So in hindsight of all that, we don't want to see $85 million spent in such a way that it doesn't become cost effective. So with the blessing of our big guy upstairs, I'm hoping to get the approval from you to present a more professional presentation here, and I'll be asking you as to when I can do that and the contact information for that.
Our very capable staff will be
happy. Thank you. You
additional information. Thank
it's
you
been
both.
Tough.
Thank you both. All right, that concludes general public comment and brings us to statewide. Mr. Ainsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is item number five, and this is our public education grant program, the awarding of our competitive Whaletail grants. And Annie Frankel, one of our really excellent staff out of our public ed division, is going to present this item. So take it away, Annie.
Thank you, Ms. Frankel.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioners. So the group of grants listed in the staff report today are recommendations for 19 projects totaling $391,721 that support experiential education and stewardship of the California coast and its watersheds. They were selected from a pool of 109 applications that requested over $2.5 million. 100% of the selected projects target audiences that are underserved by marine education. So, starting in the north, Smith River Alliance will organize and expand cleanup events and develop a waste prevention campaign for two annual community celebrations. Tollywood Dunes Stewards will create a series of interpretive outings for the general public and specifically for tribal audiences. And they will also replace wood duck nesting boxes in the dunes and marsh. They will team up with the Tolowa Dene Nation on a seed collection workshop. Trinidad Coastal Land Trust will offer a variety of education and stewardship outings for youth and adults and support in-class and field programs for Hoopa Elementary, McKinley Middle, and the local Boys and Girls Club. Friends of the Dunes will revitalize their outdoor environmental education program for 6th through 12th grade students, including creating an activity on sea level rise and the Humboldt Coastal Resilience Project. And the Mattole Restoration Council will work with a team of teachers and other organizations to implement classroom presentations, coastal field trips, and climate stewardship projects with local youth. Moving south, A Whale Tail grant will support Camp Phoenix, a three-week sleepaway camp near San Gregorio for San Jose and Oakland middle school students. Brown Girl Surf will integrate their new environmental education program into their Rising Leaders program to cultivate a pipeline of environmental ambassadors, mentors, and role models. Friends of Stossel Creek will engage K-12 students in Oakland's Fruitvale District in the watershed connections of their local neighborhood, and will also host public events, including stewardship service and a King Tides walk. A grant to Big Sur Land Trust will support free day camps for Salinas Valley youth. Guadalupe Nipomo Dune Center will provide 6 months of programming and field trips to all fifth grade students at Guadalupe's McKenzie Intermediate School, and will guide them in making presentations to the City Council on pollution prevention. Whale Tail grants support inland projects as well as coastal projects. A grant to Chico State Ecological Reserves will enhance and expand field trips for Butte County elementary students impacted by the campfire so that they can learn about watershed ecosystems, Chinook salmon life cycles, and traditional indigenous fire management techniques. A Napa County RCD program for high school students will include field trips, service, and career projects about issues impacting salmon and trout in the Napa River. A San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust project will serve Madera Unified School District 6th grade teachers and students to build watershed knowledge and raise salmon in the classroom. A grant to Kern Environmental Education Foundation will create an online curriculum library and lead Kern County students in developing plastic reduction projects at their school. And finally, there are several grants in Southern California as well. A grant to Learning Equipment Supply Service will purchase environmental science laboratory equipment for studying urban runoff, and that will be made available on loan to LA, Compton, and Inglewood teachers. Nature Collective will provide watershed programming and field work experiences to all fifth grade students in Escondido Union School District. Outward Bound Adventures will train young adults for their Diverse Outdoor Leaders Institute to lead a group of Los Angeles high school students on an otter-themed course on the Central Coast. Reef Check Foundation's Whale Tail Grant Project will train members of that Diverse Outdoor Leaders Institute in scuba and protocols for monitoring kelp and rocky reef ecosystems to assist in leading LA middle and high school students in ocean education programming. And finally, the Ocean Discovery Institute will engage students and teachers from the City Heights neighborhood of San Diego in coastal wetland education. So those are just very brief summaries of all of those projects. And I want to end with a thank you to all the California drivers who own whale tail license plates, because that's what makes these projects possible. And also thank you to everyone who donates to the Protect Our Coast and Oceans Fund on the state tax return, because that also supports these grants. If anyone does not have their whale tail license plate, please go to ecoplates.com on the internet, or you can use the form that comes with your car registration renewal to purchase your plates. And for everyone who is doing the state tax return in the next couple of months or even this weekend, the Protect Our Coast and Ocean Fund, you find it on the voluntary contribution section at the end of your form. We need to raise at least $250,000 every year to stay on the form. You can give as little as $1 or as much as you're comfortable giving. And just to reiterate, there is no general fund for these general fund money for these grants or for any of our public education programs. So these two funding sources are critical for the important work that we do. We have been seeing a decline in whale tail license plate funding of about 5% a year for the last several years. So that's of concern for us. So again, a big thank you to everyone who's already supporting our programs. And last, I'd like to point out what may be apparent. This is a highly competitive grants program. We are only able to award about 15% of the funds that are requested, and there are many very, very worthwhile projects that did not make this final list. These programs have a tremendous beneficial impact on the people that they serve and on the future of the coast. Staff is looking for ways to increase the total funding available for these grants, and we welcome your ideas and your support. And with that, you'll find the motion and resolution on page 2 of the staff report. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Frankel. I'm assuming no one's taken ex parte on this, or Commissioner Hart?
No, I don't have an ex parte, but I am a member of the board of the Smith River Alliance, which is one of the beneficiaries, and for that reason, although I've had absolutely nothing to do with the whale tail grants, although I love them and they're fantastic, I'm going to be abstaining on voting on this item. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. This item is noticed as a public hearing. I'll declare the public hearing open. I'll note that there are no requests to address the commission on this item, so I'll close the public hearing. Commissioner Wilson.
I just want to...
Sorry, I had Commissioner Groom first, followed by you. Apologies.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on Ms. Frankel's presentation. If you don't have a whale tail plate, go and get one this weekend. Fill out the form. You can go to DMV website or the Echo Plate website. But half of that money goes to environmental action groups, and half of it comes directly to the Coastal Commission. So it helps augment our budget. And not only that, it's a really cool plate. Had whales jumping out at you. And you could personalize it, or you can just get numbers, whatever you want. But please, I think everybody on the commission probably has one, and certainly those of you in the public who follow us, you might want to look into that too. The money goes to a really good cause.
Thank you, Commissioner Groom. Commissioner Wilson?
I was just going to offer, if we have a Facebook page, the Coastal Commission does, and if there was a good list of or a good advertisement for all the good programs we might approve today as an encouragement for people to contribute. So I'll be happy to share that if we make one of those. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Amenzada.
Yes, I just want to say when I first got appointed to the Coastal Commission, I frantically went on to get a whale tail plate because I felt I would be shamed and unwelcome if I dared to show up at a Coastal Commission meeting without it. And that is not the case, but maybe it sort of should be. It would be awesome if all of our Coastal Commission meetings were just full of cars with those license plates. So I want to offer a friendly challenge to my fellow commissioners to all try to get that plate by the end of the year. And along those lines, I did want to ask, I know that the funding has been a challenge as there's been more license plates. The competition has sort of intensified, and perhaps on the tax return as well. What can we do as commissioners? Commissioner Wilson just made a great offer, but what can we do this year to really be ambassadors for both these programs and help raise the funds?
I have the privilege to work closely with the public education program with Annie and Chris and the entire team. We've been working to try to figure out new ways to get more plates sold and also to increase the tax checkoff. And we'll be working a little bit more with the Resources Agency and Department of Finance and potentially the legislature to look at some structure changes. The whole license plate program is really different in the sense that there are multiple special plates, and they all have different rules for how much money goes to what fund. And the Coastal Commission's whale tail plate and the Yosemite plate are the ones that contribute the most heavily to the environmental license plate fund and less to their own fund. So that's one of the options. But the other thing, we have been supported by the Department of Finance and the Resources Agency for additional marketing, and we're doing a marketing campaign this year. So we're hoping that that assists as well. So we're looking at all sorts of options and collaboration with others. But selling more plates and getting more tax checkoff is really the best method right now.
That's excellent.
And we'll keep our budget subcommittee up to speed, too.
That's great. That's great to hear about the extra marketing. I would just encourage you also to use us commissioners as ambassadors. And I remember I made the same offer last year along with Commissioner Sundberg. So let's try to follow up on that and see how these 12 individuals can help sort of spread the word about this and help with your efforts. Thanks.
Commissioner Amenzada, I know we're having some technical difficulties. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Gold.
Thank you. I too have been a huge fan of the program, and obviously the former group I ran was a beneficiary and I think helped launch it on the Santa Monica Pier many years ago, Heal the Bay. One of the things that just sort of struck me, which I'm sure is such a big struggle with such a demand for the grants, is that, and I guess as one of the few people in the Governor Newsom administration who actually resides in Southern California, I'm very conscious of this issue, is there's a little bit of a NorCal-SoCal split on that from the standpoint of money and number of grants. You know, I remind people that the midpoint for population in the state of California is Wilshire Boulevard, which a lot of people don't know. And so that being said, how does geography come into play? Obviously, since underserved community in Southern California is pretty significant. All these projects are extremely worthy. Clearly, your demand was more than, you know, 5-6 to 1. So I completely get it. But just from the standpoint of understanding the process a little bit better, and understanding how geographic equity comes into play would be good to hear.
It does come into play. We are trying to reach as many areas of the coast in California as we can. So when we're evaluating, we do look and see where we're reaching. This year we did have more far north coast projects that were exciting and worthy. It's not always exactly like that, but I think we did do a pretty good job of catching and touching on all the areas of the coast as well as the inland. And it really is the fact that we don't have as much money as we would like, and as I said, there were at least as many grants that were very, very worthy that we weren't able to fund. So it's a struggle every year. But I appreciate your question.
Commissioner Gold, Vice Chair Brownsey.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, why does more of our money not come to us as opposed to the other accounts?
Well, we were one of the early plates. Mm-hmm. And when the legislation was passed, it was structured that way. Mm-hmm. And then later plates, they're all different pieces of legislation, so they have different structures.
So I'm thinking that that may be a teensy thing that we could tuck into some legislation, because that was actually a disincentive to me. So I made a direct contribution because I wanted 100% of my money to go to the public education programs versus just a small portion of the money to go to these programs, because they are so incredibly wonderful and creative, and really the outreach to the communities that don't necessarily have that exposure to all the beauty and fun of the coast. So anyway, I do think that that should be addressed. And so I would just encourage when the ambassadors, Commissioner Almanzada, are setting their agenda, perhaps that could be an item on the to-do list with the staff. So thank you.
We are collecting, doing some analytical work on all the different plates and creating a chart of what it is. And we were planning to give you a little bit more details at the next meeting. So you have the information. We do want to work closely with the resources agency and give them the same information, because it affects some of their programs and how they allocate money from the environmental license plate with the Department of Finance. So it's a complicated process, but we're just trying to get all the data and the facts so it's a clear everyone has the same information. We can make the best choices.
Terrific. Thank you.
It might need a legislative change, though.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Brownsey. Commissioner Uranga has access to a motion.
I move that the Commission approve the grant award set forth in the staff recommendation. I further move that the Commission authorize the Executive Director or his designee to enter into grant agreements with the grantees for allocation of these funds and to make any amendments thereto. And I recommend a yes vote.
Moved by Uranga and Wilson. Any further comment to your motions? Commissioner Turnbull-Sanders?
Very briefly, Chair Padilla, one question that we've brought up a number of times is trying to figure out how we might be able to apply for philanthropic grants, for example, to support more education programs And I just would like to note, maybe we can have a report back on how that could potentially work, because I think there are a lot of entities that would be interested in partnering. It's obviously always a challenge with staffing and time and sometimes restrictions around grants, but thinking about how we can expand our reach, given that Ms. Frankel indicated that only 15% of the applicants were able to receive funding.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there any further dialogue? Any objection to unanimous approval? Commissioner Hart will register an abstention in the record. Aside from the extension, is there any objection to an otherwise unanimous approval? Hearing none, then the awards are approved. Thank you so much. I think we've had a request for a brief bio break before taking up the SLR update, so let's recess for 10 minutes and reconvene here at 40 after. Thank you. Thank you, Billy. Welcome back. Thanks for your indulgence. We will return to statewide, and I think item 5.1, Mr. Ainsworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next item is item 5.1, and this is a continuation of our speaker series on sea level rise adaptation across the state. And so I'm going to turn it over to Alex Yee, analyst in our statewide planning division, formerly with our Long Beach office, who I pulled into the statewide planning unit. Alex, take it away.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. The next item is 5.1 on sea level rise adaptation planning, and we do have a staff presentation. If we could have that pulled up, please. Thank you. For the past five meetings, as the commission has moved around the state, statewide staff has been presenting sea level rise vulnerability in each area. In December, staff provided updates on sea level rise vulnerability here in Los Angeles County and also Ventura County, focused on vulnerable beaches, wetlands, and habitat. We know that as sea level rises, beaches will narrow due to a phenomenon known as coastal squeeze. Even today, as shown in this photo, areas that are typically wide beaches are now impassable at high tide. This photo was taken about a month ago during King Tides here at the Belmont Shore in Long Beach. So today we want to look at sea level rise planning through a slightly different lens than we typically have, and that lens is environmental justice and equity. Staff will discuss ongoing commission efforts and highlight remaining challenges, and then the commission will have the opportunity to hear from two guest presenters about potential opportunities to address these challenges through regional adaptation planning and targeted community outreach. Can I have the next slide, please? The commission has long acknowledged the connection between sea level rise vulnerability and environmental justice. The Commission's sea level rise guidance recognizes the disproportionate impact that sea level rise will have on communities with limited capacity to adapt. The Commission's environmental justice policy, as we heard this morning, similarly recognizes that beach loss and loss of coastal access will predominantly disadvantage inland residents, particularly in areas projected to face increasingly extreme heat due to climate change. The EJ policy notes that taking an environmental justice approach to the coastal policy requires a fundamental rethinking of who is connected to the coast and how. Thus, in addition to discussing areas vulnerable to inundation due to sea level rise, staff will also briefly present information related to similar and related climate impacts and social vulnerability. Could I have the next slide, please? So Los Angeles County contains 101 miles of mainland shoreline, which includes many sandy beaches like Malibu, Santa Monica, Manhattan, and Hermosa beaches. Low-lying canals in Venice, Biona, and Los Cerritos wetlands, and vulnerable development here in Long Beach, particularly in East Long Beach, such as Belmont Shore and Naples. Could I have the next slide, please? While sea level rise is a major climate concern on the coasts, another concern in inland areas is extreme heat. This map depicts the coincidence of extreme heat and social vulnerability, with higher vulnerability shown in darker red. The number of extreme heat days is only projected to increase due to climate change, exacerbated by the urban heat island effect. For inland residents, access to the coast to escape the heat will be increasingly important in the coming decades, just as sea level rise threatens to reduce access. The next slide, please. This map, which overlays the social vulnerability to environmental hazards with sea level rise vulnerability, shows areas with high vulnerability depicted in darker red, located predominantly in inland areas. Many of these residents do not live in coastal cities and may not have the opportunity to participate in sea level rise adaptation planning as part of our LCP update process. Next slide, please. With over 10 million residents, which is around 26% of the state, and I appreciate Commissioner Gold's comment about the meat population midpoint being here in Los Angeles. Los Angeles County is the largest in the nation by population and one of the most diverse counties in California. There are appreciable divides between the coastal and inland parts of the county in terms of economic, social, and climate vulnerability. However, often conversations about sea level rise can center on properties and development directly threatened by erosion or inundation. But inland residents are also coastal users and should have the right to participate in planning its future. Next slide, please. Regional planning provides a forum to emphasize connections between sea level rise and other climate impacts like extreme heat. Many cities, counties, and MPOs are undertaking climate adaptation planning on the regional level. Individual cities may also benefit from regional planning from the connections drawn between climate impacts, for example, by providing additional ways to frame connected climate issues and communicate about interrelated climate impacts. There will be more and more opportunities to participate in regional planning as a forum for the Commission to engage partners on the impacts of sea level rise and align processes at the local and regional levels. Now, staff would like to turn the presentation over to Natalie Hernandez of Climate Resolve, who will speak about ongoing climate adaptation planning efforts in Los Angeles County. Natalie will be followed by Allison Spindler Ruiz from the City of Long Beach, who will share examples and lessons from the city's targeted and inclusive climate planning outreach. Following their presentations, staff is available for questions. Thank you.
Oh, it's actually the one that says CCC presentation. I think it's that one, correct. Great, thank you. Hi, commissioners. My name is Natalie Hernandez, and I'm here on behalf of Climate Resolve, a nonprofit organization that I work for, here to present a snapshot of climate planning efforts in Los Angeles County in California. My presentation will focus on how there can be opportunities for regional collaboration and integration with local coastal programs, while taking into consideration the various climate planning efforts that are already going on. Let me take a step back and tell you a little bit about myself and Climate Resolve. I'm a resident born and raised in Long Beach, actually in Councilmember Aranga's district. And I got involved in the environmental movement because my mom, for a long time, worked at an elementary school next to a freeway that was very impacted with air pollution. And at Climate Resolve, we believe that climate change is going to exacerbate these issues and that it's a global problem, however many impacts are local. Climate Resolve communicates how climate change will affect us in Southern California and what opportunities we have to empower people on a relatable level. We know negative news turns people away from the conversation, and most people need to know how climate change affects them personally and the solutions available. Therefore, Climate Resolve leads community projects, like installing roofing and surface designs to reduce heat to help cool down a neighborhood, as well as helping school districts capture stormwater. At our heart, we are an advocacy organization pushing for climate legislation at state and local levels, like advocating for funding to help people bike, walk, or take public transit in their neighborhoods. We organize policy and science events on forward-thinking topics such as wildfire preparedness and insurance. We also do outreach in communities on behalf of utility companies like LADWP and Southern California Edison to connect people with rebates. Lastly, we help coordinate regional science and planning efforts, which is one of the reasons I'm here today to talk to you all. Here are a few recent state resources on climate adaptation planning. The first you're probably very familiar with, I brought it. It's a crosswalk booklet about coastal hazard resilience planning in California developed by you all at the Coastal Commission, alongside NOAA, the U.S. Geological Survey, OPR, Cal OES, OPC, the State Coastal Conservancy, and FEMA. What's nice about this booklet is that it's easy to read and gives an overview of types of plans that touch on coastal issues, such as local hazard mitigation plans, adaptation plans, general plans, and of course, the local coastal program. The California Adaptation Planning Guide is a more in-depth resource to equip all local governments, not just coastal communities, with what's needed to adopt long-term climate adaptation approaches. This guide references the latest adaptation tools and planning methodologies, incorporates findings from the latest climate science, and has best practices on integrating equity into the local planning processes. Cal OES, OPR, Placework, ICF, and Climate Resolve were involved in the creation of this guide. A draft is currently on the Cal OES website, and a final will be released in April 2020. The last picture in the slide is the California Adaptation Clearinghouse, or resilientca.org. It is the one-stop shop to find all California-related climate adaptation and resilient resources, like data, legislation, and case studies. I should mention that the California Adaptation Planning Guide will be integrated into this website at the end of the year. These are the first couple of resources I'm going to highlight for the LA region. First, the Regional Adapt LA, a tool for coastal impacts planning in the Los Angeles region, came out of the USCC grant as a multi-year effort to link local coastal jurisdictions and develop a community of practice. It was funded by the state between 2014 and 2019 and involved local cities from Long Beach to Malibu, 11 local municipalities, Los Angeles County, and 6 supporting organizations. It increased collaboration among coalition partners and increased use of the best available science. As a result, many cities are making significant progress in evaluating potential strategies. It served as an early jumping-off point for the vulnerability assessment done by Santa Monica for their land use plan and the Venice land use plan. Additionally, expert consultants were brought in to model shoreline change, coastal erosion, and coastal retreat under projected future climate scenarios. So this effort was integrated into the work led by U.S. Geological Survey to develop the coastal modeling system, also known as COSMOS, for Southern California. Then on the left and the right here, the Los Angeles Regional Collaborative for Climate Actions and Sustainability, or LARC, is a membership network of local and regional decision makers, ensuring that a sustainable Los Angeles County is prepared for climate change. In 2016, LARC released the Climate Action Framework, which synthesized mass information on climate change science and mandated state policies. It provides potential actions in a clear and concise way so that local practitioners can make wise choices and investments most appropriate for their specific community and collectively for Los Angeles. Particularly, it has a section on ocean and coastal resources. The other two resources that I'm highlighting for the LA region are the Gateway Council of Governments, or Gateway COG, which created a climate action planning framework, and then the SCAG has also created a regional climate adaptation framework. For the Gateway COG framework, they helped local jurisdictions develop voluntary climate action plans for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in their communities. The CAP framework also includes an adaptation toolkit and is intended to help individual communities with economic development, public health, air quality, climate resiliency, equity, and jobs. This resource has been particularly helpful for the smaller cities in the Gateway COG region who are struggling to wrap their heads around climate change. Additionally, over the past year, SCAG has been putting together the Regional Climate Adaptation Framework for 6 counties and 191 cities so that they can all work together to plan and prepare for the impacts of sea level rise, extreme heat, wildfires, and other climate-related issues. This framework is expected to be released at the end of this month, February 2020. So this slide helps drive through that more regional collaboration is needed because each year there are climate planning related laws that are making mandates and funding programs to do the type of work that I just presented on, alongside all the other work being done by the Coastal Commission on the LCPs. Some of the major laws that have passed related to climate adaptation are SB 379, which requires communities to incorporate climate change in the safety element of their general plan. SB 246, which directed OPR to create Integrated Climate Adaptation and the Resiliency Program, or ICARP, which is designed to develop a cohesive and coordinated effort across state and local and regional levels. And one main component of this program is the resilientca.org website that I showed earlier. SB 1482 requires state agencies to promote the use of climate adaptation strategies to inform planning decisions and ensure that state investments consider climate change impacts when developing infrastructure. And lastly, SB 1000 requires an environmental justice element, goals and policies to be adopted in the general plan, ensuring that the most vulnerable communities to climate change and other environmental hazards are protected. So I gave a snapshot of state, LA region, state and LA region resources, as well as recent climate planning laws. Now I want to talk about the opportunities for more collaboration. First, there's a role for nonprofit network and academic organizations like Climate Resolve, LARC, and USC Sea Grant to be a boundary organization or liaison in these planning efforts, to bring various stakeholders together to frame climate change holistically and to push creative thinking amongst government. For example, Climate Resolve has led several climate symposia in partnership with the CEC, USC Sea Grant, and other partners to disseminate research on climate science, including sea level rise. Climate Resolve is also actively assisting local governments to get funding for climate planning. For the Council of Governments and Metropolitan Planning Organizations like Gateway COG and SCAG, their role can be to administer climate planning grants. SCAG already does this with the heat island reduction plans that include urban greening and cool streets. And then COGS and MPOs can also facilitate the creation of region-wide planning resources, such as what was done with the climate action planning framework for 28 of the member cities in the Gateway COG. Lastly, the role of the Coastal Commission, you all, can be to figure out a way to have LCPs be flexible to climate adaptation planning processes and to streamline LCPs with efforts already going on. On one end, some jurisdictions find it challenging to be on specific grant timelines with LCPs. And on the other hand, the Coastal Commission might see that adaptation planning processes already going on might be too broad or don't get the specificity and actual adaptation measures that an LCP requires. Therefore, there needs to be a way to work more closely together on this and not have adaptation planning be a separate effort from the LCP. With that, I will take questions at the end, and I'm going to pass it over to the wonderful Allison Splendler, who is going to present on the Long Beach Climate Action and Adaptation Plan.
Good morning, commissioners. It's great to be with you all here this morning. Thanks for coming to our beautiful city of Long Beach. And I've got the other presentation. Yes.
My name is Allison Spindler Ruiz, and I'm a planner here at the City of Long Beach. I'm the project manager for developing our climate action and adaptation plan, and I've been asked to focus on sharing with you all some of the strategies that we've developed to facilitate a community-centered, inclusive process for developing our CAP. This first slide here, you'll see some of the faces of residents of Long Beach who've been involved in developing our CAP so far. We've reached an estimated 10,000 Long Beach residents in the process through a variety of events with a focus on reaching young people, communities of color, and others most impacted by climate change here in our city. And we do that by having, you know, it's not rocket science, but it starts with science, using a process that looks at how climate change is already impacting our communities and how it's projected to impact them further in the future, and then using that information to develop a preliminary engagement strategy. Once we did that, we conducted what's called an equity assessment, using a tool from the Government Alliance on Race and Equity to understand who would be impacted, how we could reach people that are traditionally left out of the planning process. And we worked with partners such as our health department and parks department, who do tend to work with communities more impacted and vulnerable communities in Long Beach on a day-to-day basis, to come up with multilingual strategies, strategies for partnering with existing initiatives, and ways to reach people that our planning process doesn't always do traditionally. And that starts by meeting people where they are, whether it's at existing community festivals or with community organizations, relationship building, trying different things and not being afraid to fail, and then co-learning with the community and continuing to iterate. I mentioned it starts with data, so we were very careful in developing an independent scientific working group who advised our climate action planning process. You can see the members listed on the left hand of the slide, and they include academics, local experts in everything from sea level rise to air quality and heat island effect. And we required that there be someone that had published at least some information on equity issues in Long Beach as part of that scientific working group. And they helped advise what data we collected, our methodologies, and to help validate those. I think most of you are familiar with Long Beach, but just to give you a quick context, you see here a part of our beautiful coast. It's 52 square miles. We're almost 500,000 residents. We're ranked one of the most walkable and bikeable cities in the country. But we recognize that although we're an extremely diverse community, we're also a very segregated community, like many communities across the country. I know you're all familiar with Cal and Bioscreen. The map on the top left shows the Cal and Bioscreen impacts for Long Beach. You can see that in Central, West, and North Long Beach in red are highest on the cumulative disadvantage index, and that you can actually go 2.2 miles and be in the 95 to 100th percentile, which means you're worse off than 95 to 100% of census tracts, and in 2 miles be in the 10 to 15th top percent for the least vulnerability. That's existing environmental justice issues. If you look then at the top center map, extreme heat vulnerability, based on climate change data, we see those same communities in red. Layer on that social vulnerability to climate change, again, you see almost the same pattern. And on the bottom left, percentage of white residents in our community, the darker the red, the more white residents, and you see almost an exact inverse pattern. And then on the bottom right, where our youngest residents live, you can see that the darker the red, the more proportion of children under the age of 10. So it's our youngest people that will not only live with these issues the longest, but are living in the areas most impacted by climate change. So we have substantial impacts related to sea level rise as well, as was mentioned. But and this is 2030 king tide and storm-based flooding potential. Here's a 2050 map. You can see most of those flooding impacts are in more well-off parts of our city. Although West Long Beach is there as well, it's projected to be protected by the port adaptation planning work already underway. So going back to extreme heat, just like it's true across the globe, in Long Beach, extreme heat is projected to have the most severe life and safety impacts of any climate change impact. For us in Long Beach, nearly 275,000 of our residents are in the highest heat vulnerability zone. Heat can lead to heat-related illness, injury, and death. It worsens air quality, and it's particularly dangerous for children, older adults, people with respiratory disease, and those who work outdoors. It can lead to missed work days, school days, damage to roads, highways, and rail. And you can see on the bottom left for Long Beach, historically we've had 4 extreme heat days a year. By 2050, we're expecting somewhere between 11 and 16, and by 2100, up to 37. But it's actually not a future problem. This is a present problem. If you look in the last 10 years, we've averaged almost 8.5 extreme heat days, not 4. And if you can see which year we had the most number of extreme heat days, it was 2015. And in 2015, during a heat wave, we had a week-long power outage that left many of our residents without power. You can see some excerpts from Twitter here on the left. And really, for everyone, issues that are here today are more front and center, but particularly our communities most vulnerable are dealing with how to get through today and tomorrow. And so framing climate change as an issue of today, not just the future, has been an important part of our message. You can also see on the right, we had a really intense rainstorm a couple of years ago that made it hard for our 911 responders and others to reach residents. Again, those more intense storms leading to impacts today. So when we went out and started talking to people about these issues, one group of older adults who invited us to their member meeting were the Long Beach Gray Panthers. They're a great group. And they, when we started mentioning the heat wave and the power outage, they actually had stories of many of them were in that power outage and lived for a week without ability to get up and down their elevators, without keeping their medication or food refrigerated. And they wanted to share their stories. So after we started talking, they came to us and wanted to co-plan an event. And actually, in his role as council member, Commissioner Urunger here co-sponsored that event called Extreme Heat, Staying Safe in the Face of Climate Change. And we talked about climate change impacts, including things like access to the coast. But we also talked about day-to-day impacts, like how to deal with the health impacts, how to keep people safe, how to recognize heat stroke, and how to be certified for emergency response. We also mentioned how young people are impacted by climate change disproportionately. Of course, young people are going to inherit this climate crisis. And so we've worked very intentionally in developing relationships with school groups, with our school district. We're a partner in the school science fair at Long Beach Unified. And last year, the winners of the science fair got to showcase their work at our Climate Fest event. We also work with youth leadership groups and initiatives who have done class projects, created Instagram accounts, and are helping us get the word out across Long Beach. If you remember the map before about how communities of color are disproportionately impacted, Long Beach is about 40% Latino. And when we thought about engagement with the Latino community, we started by meeting people where they are, going to events like festivals and events in the park. And then we developed a partnership with a local organization called Latinos in Action. And we were hosted at their fair where we gave away air purifiers and had our Spanish-speaking staff participate. And after that, we built enough trust where they invited us to come co-host an event with them. They made recommendations such as using the Loteria game, sort of like bingo if you're not familiar, to go over cap concepts. We also highlighted examples that are working around adaptation planning in Latin America to uplift what's working. And continue to build that trust and ask people, you know, what their input is around climate change and what we can do. Similarly, Long Beach has the largest Cambodian population outside of Cambodia. And so when we were developing a strategy with working the Cambodian population, it started again with going to meet people where they are. And we have Khmer-speaking staff here in Development Services who helped us do that. We would go to things like business assistant workshops and health fairs, and eventually we're invited to have a table at Cambodian New Year. We also created an advertisement shown on the right, and we were advised to do a really interesting translation approach where we were told to translate the headlines in Khmer, but keep the detail in English because most older Cambodians read Khmer only, and most younger Cambodians only read English. We're also advised to work through a local Khmer TV station and to create animated videos. And those were some interesting tips that we got. Finally, it's not just about events. Taking an environmental justice approach is also about what goes in the plan. So to us, it's really important to recognize these environmental justice issues in the plan itself. This is an excerpt from the introduction of our draft plan, recognizing the historic injustices and inequities that are still with us today and how that creates a geography of differentiated risk around climate change and the role that government and planning has played in that. How we communicate also matters. So on the left, you could see a typical notice a city might give. And on the right, you can see a postcard we sent out to every resident in our sea level rise vulnerability area for the year 2050, which says, your house is in the sea level rise vulnerability area. Here's a link to the map, and invited them to a panel to discuss. You can imagine we got a good turnout. We had almost 300 residents attend, and it ironically rained really hard and the parking lot flooded. We had Dr. Schubel from the aquarium come speak about sea level rise and the long-range need to retreat. We also had a local architect come talk about what we can do in the interim and how to adapt. And then I spoke about sort of the policy and public side of it. But as we close, I want to mention not everyone wants to come to a panel. Can you advance the slide? Oh, okay, froze. Okay. Well, not everyone wants to come to a panel. My next slide was going to show a picture of our climate fest where we took over a parking lot in our sea level rise vulnerability zone. And we actually hired a local chalk artist who chalked up the sea level rise projections on the parking lot. And then we had a collaborative art project where everyone would add to that piece. And it helped raise awareness while using art and creativity to do something a little bit lighter, because not everyone is ready to take a really deep and hard conversation about climate change. And just as we close, wanted to, you know, make that point that it's about not just the process, but transparency of how the process leads to different policy, and how we've been very transparent in what community feedback leads to in the draft plan, as well as focusing on capacity building, not just engaging people for the sake of checking the box, but how do we build those planning abilities so that they can continue to be in the process, because this is just the beginning. We know we have a lot of work to do, and that it's going to take a long time to deal with the structural and systemic inequities that we face, and that we'll need to keep working with and for the community to do it. Thank you very much.
Well done. Oh, thank you.
There it is, if you see on the top right, the art project.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we need to close, Mr. Yee or Mr. Ainsworth?
Yeah, that concludes our presentation, and we really want to thank our speakers. I thought that was really fabulous.
They did a fantastic job, really, as always.
Different perspective how we can reach out to these communities.
Thank you. I do have some slips to address the commission on this item. Aaron Berry. On behalf of the California Association of Realtors, Smart Coast, California. Welcome.
Thank you. First, I want to thank the commission for all your work. My name is Aaron Berry. I live in Long Beach, and I'm a local realtor working 18 years in Los Angeles and Orange counties up and down the coast. This makes me one of 250,000 realtors in California. I'm also one of the 800 directors of the California Association of Realtors. Housing is important, which is why I'm here today. In our efforts to be constructive, the California Association of Realtors has worked hard to create an effective organization called Smart Coast California. With Smart Coast California, the California Association of Realtors are advocates for solutions to address sea level rise and its nuances throughout the state. As Californians, we're all in this together. We need to work together to find solutions as partners for all of California, both coastal and inland. Smart Coast California hopes to continue to engage with your staff and you to work together on those solutions. As a director, I personally want to thank our Smart Coast consultant here, Don Schmitz. Most importantly, we want to thank you for all your work, the work you're doing on the issues of sea level rise, and we look forward to our mutual endeavors. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Sergio Macias from Smart Coast, California.
Hi there. So I've been a realtor here for 23 years.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank Sergio Macias, M-A-C-I-A-S. And I've been a realtor here for 23 years, and I do endorse Park Coast, California. I've been an active member of this community since relocating here from Los Angeles in 1992. I'm a graduate of the chemical engineering program at Cal State Long Beach, a graduate of Leadership Long Beach. I'm an officer of the Bluff Park Neighborhood Association, and I'm a local business owner. I've owned Hot Java for the last 15 years. I'm president emeritus of Long Beach Pride and served as a board member there for 14 years. And I want to thank all of you for your time here, the work you're doing here, and I especially want to recognize Councilmember Roberto and his wife Tanya Uranga for the continuous stewardship for diversity, for access, for the city as a whole, and the environment. We at Smart Coast California want to continue to do our part to support a greater purpose, and that purpose being to work together for a long-term strategy for sea level rise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Macias. Next up is Don Schmitz with Smart Coast California. Please state your name for the record.
For the record, I'm Don Schmitz. Good morning, commissioners. I'll make this very brief. We have been working feverishly to catch up. The California Association of Realtors formed this organization and really got going about 5-6 months ago. We've been liaisoning with your staff. We've been having conversations with some 12 counties and cities which are actively creating their local coastal program amendments, the 40-plus which have done their vulnerability assessments. And I think that this organization with thousands and thousands of realtors who are in the trenches for so many communities are just absolutely integral to making a bridge, a conduit between the different regulatory agencies and these communities, because there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution to this. There's going to be different communities, different neighborhoods. It's really going to be that detailed. And I was very struck by the presentation today. I made a presentation to the California Association of Realtors conference last week and was discussing sea level rise and how this commission has taken a lead to come up with regulations to address this and how we had to be part of that constructive engagement to find these solutions. And one of the groups of realtors that came up to thank me for the presentation and had a lot of interest were from Bakersfield. Bakersfield. Now, you typically don't think about a community like that really being concerned about sea level rise, but the fact of the matter is, and this is something you understand at a visceral level, which is that the coast, the 1,100 miles of the coast, is really a defining geomorphic feature for the entire state. Economically, recreational opportunities, it's where everybody wants to go. And the real estate community has tremendous skin in the game in regards to this. They're not just about selling houses. They're about dynamic communities. They're about commercial centers. They're about recreational opportunities. And another thing a lot of folks are realizing all over the state is that the critical infrastructure improvements, modifications, and changes that we're going to have to do are something that the taxpayers are going to have to incur the cost for across the entire state. So one of the things that I've been trying to promote is, in fact, and you heard some of the previous speakers address this, we are all in this together. None of us can ignore this. And this California Coastal Commission is out front, as well it should be, to address this particular issue. It's not the only agency, but it is quite arguably one of the most important ones. So we are trying to take these monthly staff presentations, which are very instructive, and we're trying to take them to the different organizations and local communities and distribute them and promote them so that people can be educated and can be part of the process. I want to thank you very, very much for the work that you're doing, that your staff's doing, and we're looking forward to continue to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. Next is Judith Davis. Davies, she has time ceded to her by Kathy Knight and Patricia McPherson. And just want to reiterate that this is on sea level rise.
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Yes.
Thanks. State your name for the record.
My name is Judith Davies, and I'm here speaking also on behalf of the Sierra Club, the Airport Marina Group, and Grassroots Coalition. First, I want to say that I was delighted to find the source report referred to by the Coastal Commission called, we could go to the next slide. This report that I looked at and started, reading through, and there was so much information and so informative and new, and it was very positive for me to have that kind of input, and I just kept reading it, and I just want to thank you so much for all the work that went into that and everybody that was involved in that, because it's very positive, reinforcing that there are ways of dealing with sea level rise, and where we are with this, we have so many questions and concerns and worries, so thank you for that. Reading through it and comparing maps, seeing the variety and makeup of coastal areas and how they can be protected and or mitigated with these rapid changes, it's an invaluable source, and I'm relieved that it exists, and I'm thankful to all of those who put it together, and I will refer to it very often and spend time rereading it. The assessments of our coast, giving the projected 5-foot sea level rise, they use to calculate conditions and changes that may occur with all the maps going all the way down the coast. My concern is of course in our area, the Biona wetlands, and what sea level rise would do to that, and also a potential project that is being presented in this final EIR for the Biona wetlands restoration. I was struck by something I read quickly through it on page 85. Let's see, the next slide. Here, managers are becoming increasingly aware of the complex and dynamic impacts to sediment and water flow dynamics on coastal habitats, and are developing creative management strategies to mitigate these impacts. Examples of practices to manage in place for resilience range from the manual placement of sediments, thin layer sediment augmentation, the removal of levees around the estuarine marshes and dams upstream, improving flushing dynamics on the marsh, etc. So, all of that feeds into more information as to how to approach a wetlands with all the complex dynamics and forces that are, always in motion and changing. Struggling with this FEIR that finally was released in December, it seemed to me that in spite of its enormous length, something like 5,000 pages, which I, am dealing with piece by piece, but very small pieces, I'm much more delighted and encouraged by reading your information. This seems to be to remain largely the same as it was presented over 10 years ago, with no really the predetermined choice of turning the wetlands largely into a salt marsh with full tidal inflow from the ocean. This makes no sense to me today with sea level rise certainty. The plan is based on a static engineered structural development, which seems to be more designed as a flood control basin or something, but I don't see how that will work either, really. If anything, it makes it more condensed, more possible for a sort of bore effect to go up the levees of Bionic Creek and maybe affect even people further up the line, like in Culver City and so on, where I know that I've taken photographs myself of some of those areas and streets going across and bridges. They need reinforcing, and certainly with the berms and so on that they're suggesting with the other plan, it's going to affect all the way up the line. The wetlands are extremely important in the process of reducing global. We could go to the next slide. There are only like three slides. The wetlands are extremely important in the process of reducing global warming and climate change, we know. Wetlands capture and store in their plants, sediments, and soils 4 times more CO2 than even terrestrial forests. 90% of California's coastal wetlands have been destroyed, and Bayona is one of the last seasonal freshwater coastal wetlands. This, as I call big dig out, would not only take 10 years and cost $200 million, initial estimates, and would be releasing large amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere with the bulldozing and digging out, with the removal of these soils. It is also complicated by SoCal Gas underground storage and extraction facilities. This is coming up. Extraction facilities that produce more methane and toxic gases, which would be released as these gas migrate, and SoCal Gas has extended their underground storage beyond what they're initially permitted to do under their CUP. So it would seem to me that the area was slowly built up with silt and sediment from the combined waters that flowed from Bayona Creek, Centinela Creek, and the LA River for thousands of years, really, till the LA River was redirected and increasingly cut off from the tidal inflow, which I had pointed out in an earlier slide. So I can go down past this. I also present here a map of the LA watershed from Santa Monica Mountains running all the way down through the basin, through the aquifers that are underneath in the wetlands. We haven't cleaned our waters that are coming down all through the watershed. And before we actually introduce water back into the Bayona wetlands or back into the ocean, we need to really take it hard and clean the Bayona, clean these storm drain waters, the pollutants, and so on. It's unacceptable to allow this to happen any longer, either for the coast or for any other possibility of discharging through the wetlands. I'd also finally like to refer to a recent article here. Scientists make discovery. Let's see, that would be the next slide, I think. It's a short, small picture there. But the article is here, and I'm going to submit the entire report, November, this was published November 5th, 2019, in which the study at University of Georgia looks at eddies and swells off the coast of California, showing that these swells transport nutrients far out into the deep ocean. Then we can also conclude, most likely we are also sending vast amounts of waste, garbage, toxic chemicals far out into the deeper regions of the ocean from the coast ourselves. We can't discuss any restoration, as I said, of the wetlands till we deal with this issue. These waters could then be used, if they were suitable, to be used to recharge the aquifers at Bayona Wetlands, create new habitats, and produce a thriving freshwater wetlands with only occasional tidal inflow as it once was. It would produce the kind of buffer zone that is natural to wetlands for flooding, and it can be allowed and also encouraged to build up higher ground over time to counter against sea level rise conditions as it may occur in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Davies. Appreciate that. Next up is Melinda Cotton. And if you could state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Yes, my name is Melinda Cotton. I live in Belmont Shore. That's a very lovely place to live, but we're two blocks from the beach, so we're going to be among the first affected by climate change, and we're actually already seeing it. With the heat spells that we've had flooding in front of our house. Allison and I just talked on Monday about that. The rainstorms are coming from the extra heat, so that's important. The weather has gotten so that we installed solar on our roof so we can feel comfortable having air conditioning, which we have never needed before. So we definitely feel for the people who are coming inland to the shore to enjoy the beach and the cooler weather. And we're certainly trying to protect the beach, as I've spoken earlier. The Aquarium of the Pacific, Dr. Schubel, and the League of Women Voters and the Nature Conservancy have had so far three, really. The League of Women Voters has had six climate change symposiums. They do one every spring. They have excellent speakers. They're archived on the aquarium website. So I hope that everybody will be aware of those and look at them. The last one was focused on Belmont Shore and the peninsula. And again, they were really excellent and very concerned. We hope you'll read a book called The Uninhabitable Earth. It came out last summer, has excellent research, and it's very, very scary. I would try to just briefly ask you again. I did speak yesterday morning about saving Olympic Plaza Park, which is on the beach. They have moved the latest version of the Belmont Beach and Aquatic Center has moved the pool inland some feet. It's supposed to be on the line that supposedly the sea level rise is not supposed to go over, but there's no guarantee of that. It's happening a lot faster than any of us expect. So we're hoping, I know a gentleman earlier spoke about moving the pool to another location. We have repeatedly, and I know coastal staff has mentioned, the pool could go on the elephant lot. It's the convention center. As a 13-acre parking lot, the LA 28 Olympics plans to put a temporary pool there for water polo. And so why not put the Belmont pool there, which is going to be a competitive swimming and diving operation in part. And the pool would also serve Commissioner Uranga's neighborhood. So we're hoping that that would happen and that the city will see it feasible to do that. And again, thanks to all the commissioners. I know you were here at 9 a.m. yesterday morning. You went to 8 last night. And we really thank you for everything you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cotton. I want to thank all the public speakers. Now we're going to turn it back to the commissioners for questions. First up is Commissioner Turnbull Sanders. And does anyone else like to address the issue of sea level rise?
Thank you, Vice Chair Brownsey. I really enjoyed the presentation by Ms. Hernandez, and could you say your name, the representative from Long Beach? Ms. Spindler, both of your presentations I thought were a really good example of how local jurisdictions could involve communities that have typically been left out of the process. And Ms. Spindler, I particularly appreciated your comments about capacity building. And I think that's one of the things that often gets lost is you typically have organizations and many times environmental organizations that kind of helicopter into communities and then they help provide services and then they leave without building the internal capacity for future engagement. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Ms. Hernandez for her exemplary work in a kind of seminal piece that I use all the time called Measures Matter around the equitable distribution of public resources and how that can influence more sustainable communities and particularly in disadvantaged communities. So excellent presentation. I just really appreciate both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up is Commissioner Gold.
Thank you. I also thought that Natalie, Allison, and Alex gave Very helpful presentation. So thank you. I would just sort of add, since we Allison gave it, I'm sorry, Natalie gave a good overview of what's going on in the region. That the City of LA Green New Deal document has a lot of pertinent information related to this as well as the city's resilience plan that Lucy Jones worked on. There's a lot of good stuff in there on extreme heat. One of the things that has come out in dealing with these sorts of issues is trying to figure out where your cooling centers are in relation to your disadvantaged communities and why they did or did not get used during some of the extreme heat that occurred. It was kind of shocking how they weren't used. I mean, UCLA, we had a 112-degree day, which was pretty amazing during that time period. And it sort of opened up everybody's eyes on cooling centers and that a lot of education and cultural change needs to occur on people using them. So I'm sure you guys, that's included in there and you're giving broad overviews. I understand, but sometimes those sorts of maps are also pretty helpful in telling the story as well. One of the other things I just want to bring up is, I'm very happy that Resources Agency as well as OPC is working so closely with the Coastal Commission on these issues. We're trying to all get on the same page, and this came from a request from four of the commissioners to sort of lead an effort together jointly on getting about a dozen different agencies in the state on the same page of just principles to work under on sea level rise. And we're pretty far along on this, pretty shockingly, in such a short period of time. And so hopefully we'll have something to report on maybe as early as the next meeting on that. Maybe that's a little overly ambitious, but I think that would be great. And then just the last thing I did want to bring up is that in the strategic plan for California's ocean and coast, which will be voted on at the OPC meeting on the 26th, there's some pretty significant issues and targets that are in there for sea level rise, including how to use the guidance, sort of a floor for what we should be building in for resilience as early as 2050, and a number of other different issues. One of the things, because I know that social justice is such a high priority for the Coastal Commission, that I urge you to take a look at is the impacts of sea level rise on infrastructure, especially in underserved communities, and what that could mean to those communities. Because I think that's an area that we touched upon, but I think is going to become a much larger issue, and whether it's sites that have had previous pollution problems and the like that are now vulnerable to sea level rise. I think it's something to take a hard look at, and so I just encourage you to start doing that sort of moving forward in the future. And I could go on forever, but I won't, so thanks.
Good choice, Commissioner. I just want to take just one moment of personal privilege before I ask Commissioner Rice to offer comments. Commissioner Gold referenced the statewide effort in terms of getting the agencies on the same page. I just want to shout out his work and the work of Commissioner Amanzada, who I believe with their vision, their hard work, and mostly, and so importantly on this issue, their sense of humor, produced an incredibly effective meeting, an incredibly effective document, which is a statement of sea level rise principles for the state. So I just want to do that shout out. Next, Commissioner Rice.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the presentations this morning, and I don't know if I've been asleep for the last however many years in thinking about climate change. But it just really became so stunning to me today, especially listening, I think, to the Long Beach, the work that Long Beach is doing in it with its CAAP on the intersection. I mean, we tend to think of climate change impacts as being much more physical, sea level rise. You know, we do our sea level rise vulnerability assessments. But really, there's the physical impacts, the social impacts, and the public health impacts. and the intersection of it all. And interestingly enough, the work of the Coastal Commission and access to the coast and our coastal communities are right sort of at the vortex of that, of those three. Whether you live in Bakersfield or Sacramento or right on the coast. So I just appreciate, especially I'm going to be sharing the work and the process that Long Beach is doing with my community, and I'm sure Chair Groom and I will be sharing it with our the Bay Area Air Quality Management District as we think about a lot of air quality issues with regards to climate change. But I just really appreciate the presentations today.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Rice. Next up is Commissioner Urunga.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I too want to thank the individuals who came out, and the presentations were wonderful. They're very, very informative. I also want to thank my Long Beach community members who are out there who decided to come today and share their experiences and their thoughts on what's taking place here in Long Beach. The CAP, the Clean Air Action Plan, has been in effect now for a number of years and in development stages, and the, I'm very glad to see that the sharing of those outreach efforts that we've done have been working. I mean, I've been to a few of those. I went to the one with Dr. Schubel out at the Golden Sales Hotel last year sometime. And unfortunately, Dr. Schubel is retiring. So we're going to have a brain drain, so to speak, with his departure, but the fight will continue on, and the educational efforts will continue on. I'm also glad to see that the realtors mobilized. There you go. That's a good word. Mobilized to also get involved in this effort, because obviously, with all the issues that we're dealing with in terms of managed retreat and everything else that's coming along with sea level rise. You know, obviously the realtor sector of our community is going to be very much involved and included in those efforts, and being involved and engaged in this effort is going to be very important for us as well as we get your viewpoints and your perspectives on what's taking place with sea level rise. This morning, I had the honor of interviewing our chair, Steve Padilla, on our local TV channel, Go Long Beach. And we talked a little bit about sea level rise and the effects that it's going to have, not only here in Long Beach, but up and down the coast and everywhere where there's going to be an impact on that. We're talking about, you know, I mean, the number keeps changing as we keep going forward. Somebody mentioned about that it's coming sooner than we expected. And we're looking at the, you know, when we first started this about 2 or 3 years ago, we were talking about sea level rise and creating the sea level rise adaptation plan. We were looking at those days maybe between now and 2050 that we would have maybe a 3-foot increase in sea level rise, but we're experiencing that now. So we're looking at maybe 10 feet by the time 2100 comes along. So, I mean, it's much more imperative today that we start getting ourselves educated, getting ourselves aware as to what's coming down. And I especially want to thank also Ms. Hernandez for your presentation on what's going on in Sevilla. You're a 7th District resident. All right, well, wonderful. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to have a few brief comments, and then we're going to move to the rest of the agenda because I know we have some commissioners with time constraints. Just quickly also want to thank you. You are that glimmer of hope that we don't get to see often enough. So I would just want to thank Ms. Hernandez and Ms. Spindler for your work. It is so critically important, and I want to thank all the people here in this room who contribute to that. But quickly, I just wanted to just mention that the Commission also has a residential planning guidance document, which is incredibly helpful planning tool for local communities, and particularly for homeowners, but it's also an educational tool. I bring that to your attention to be included as a resource. And then the Commission is working with the League and with CSAC. In fact, we have a local government planning group, Commissioner Bochco and myself, along with Director Ainsworth and Madeline Cavallari on our staff, to really try to find common language, common ground. And lastly, I would love to continue a conversation with both of you, given your community work, your and the dedication, you know, of your intellectual lives to this, which is the thing that we keep running into with our local governments, our cities and our counties and, you know, the other local entities, is where does flexibility collide with resistance? And so to have your brilliance kind of bring some attention to that, and perhaps we can talk with you and you can inform us in terms of your experiences, I think that would be incredibly helpful. So with that, thank you, commissioners, for all of the comments, and then we're going to move to the main agenda. Thank you, particularly Mr. Yee. Excellent job. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. That does take us briefly to the San Diego Coast District Consent Calendar, item 6 on the agenda. There's one application for a dock project in Carlsbad and one application for a new electrical switch station at UCSD. Conditions are acceptable to the applicants. No known opposition, so staff's recommending these items get approved on consent.
Thank you. Mr. Schwang, quickly, any ex partes on this issue? Seeing none, we do have one speaker who would like to address this, Audrey Popovich, 6A. Mr. Popovich, we are experiencing a little bit of a time crunch, so I'm going to limit your time to 2 minutes, if that's okay. Okay, thank you.
Hey, Papa. I'm Andrei Popovich with Swift Sleep. I'm here with our client to answer any questions that you may have. If you have any questions, I just want to thank you, Commission, for all your hard work. I came here from Russia 10 years ago, enjoying California from cold country. And it's amazing to see all hard work that you do to keep it nice, clean, and good-looking. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Popovich, and welcome. Do I see a motion? 6A, the consent calendar.
Yeah, I move that we approve consent.
Okay, the item's been moved and seconded, moved by Wilson, seconded by Yuranga. Do we have any objection? Okay, seeing none, these items have been approved.
Wonderful.
Moving on.
Thank you so much.
So, good morning, or good afternoon, actually. So we're now at the North Coast portion of today's agenda, and item 7, the Deputy Director Report. I first want to note that we mistakenly included in the DDR a draft letter to approve an emergency permit waiver that was requested by Caltrans to remove 38 eucalyptus trees and prune an additional 139 due to a safety concern. That certain trees or branches could fall within the roadway of the Highway 101 corridor up in Humboldt County during the winter storm season. And actually, under the Commission's regulations, the Executive Director does have the authority to approve such a waiver without first seeking the Commission's concurrence if the Director agrees that the work qualifies for an emergency waiver. And that is the case here. So earlier this week, we provided an approval letter to Caltrans. And I also want to note that we're working with Caltrans staff to actually have them apply for a permit application to do maintenance for these trees over a certain period of time so that there's a public process for this. In the written Deputy Director report today is a waiver and immaterial amendment that do require your concurrence, and we've received no comments or these, are not aware of any opposition, and so we therefore seek your concurrence in approving those two items.
Thank you very much, Ms. Detmer. Are there any ex parte on any respect to any of these items? Seeing none, is there? I do have one request to address the commission on this item from Bonnie Neely. Welcome back.
It's not on. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. It's a pleasure to be here today. Does that sound okay? My name is Bonnie Neely. I'm a resident of Humboldt County, California. I'm a former Humboldt County supervisor and a former 12-year member of the commission. And I'm here today to address you regarding the after-the-fact emergency permit waiver for Caltrans to remove the trees and to trim them as well. I think you probably know from your visit to our area last August that there are hundreds of people that would like to talk to you about the tree situation, but I must say that I'm very happy with Allison Detmeyer's proposal that a maintenance permit be required. I think that'll take a lot of drama out of the situation, and it'll create a vehicle for the public to participate in the decision-making. So with that being said, I know you're really busy today. I support Allison's suggestion, and I hope Caltrans will as well. I want to also say that your staff, Allison, Bob Merrill, and Melissa Kramer were absolutely outstanding in responding to probably hundreds of calls that they received from people that sort of woke up on a Tuesday morning with these trees being cut down and just not knowing what had happened or why. And they did a great job of addressing concerns from the public and also addressing questions from the press. So with that, I'll just say that's all I need to say today, and thank you for very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. There are no further requests to address the commission on this item. Is there any objection to unanimous concurrence? Hearing none, commission concurs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That brings us to item 8, which is the North Coast Consent Calendar. As Carl noted during his summary of the agenda changes earlier, there is one North Coast item that's been moved, which is item 10A, the Caltrans Permit Amendment for modifications to the Highway 101 Eureka Arcata Corridor Project. After publication of the report, the commission had received a comment letter from Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities and other environmental groups that raised concerns about the 4-foot shoulder widths that would be provided along the new northbound auxiliary lane, which was part of the amendment. There also were concerns about highway capacity. Since publication of the staff report, receipt of that letter, Caltrans has submitted a project description change to delete the auxiliary lane, and so the concerns about the shoulder are deleted as well. That there is still a change to the hydroacoustic standards of the conditions of the permit, which remains, but as there is no comment on those, staff decided to move that part, move the amendment to consent. I will say there is an addendum that does revise the staff recommendation to delete all the references and findings having to do with the auxiliary lane. And so with that, we're recommending that the commission adopt the staff recommendation as revised and approve it under the consent calendar.
Thank you very much. Any ex parte on this item? Is there a motion to
move consent?
Wait, hold on. I had ex parte this item.
Sorry.
All right, Mr. Wilson.
But those are in the record, and they were conversations with Colin Fisk, who was mentioned here, and also had conversations with staff at Caltrans as well.
Okay, and they're on file. Hmm. Any others? Is there a motion to adopt?
Move consent.
Second.
Moved by Brownsey and Groom. Any further discussion? Any objection to unanimous adoption? Hearing none, the consent calendar is adopted.
That brings us to item 9A, the Caltrans application for restoration and enhancement of a wetland parcel near Arcata, referred to as the Samoa parcel. I do have a PowerPoint, if we could bring that up. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. If we could move to slide 2, please. If you could advance the slide. Thank you. Slide 2 is a vicinity map that shows the location with the star at the north end of Humboldt Bay, just west of Arcata. Next slide, please. The property is an agricultural parcel that was part of a larger area that was diked off from Humboldt Bay in the early 1900s. Slide 3 here shows the location of the parcel in relation to surrounding properties. You can see how the parcel is separated from Humboldt Bay at the bottom by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife area, and doesn't have the direct connection to Humboldt Bay. Next slide, please. The purpose of the project is to modify the existing freshwater agricultural wetlands and estuarine brackish marsh that are degraded, and to restore and enhance a combination of freshwater, estuarine, riparian, habitats. Slide 4 here shows the conceptual habitat plan. Basically, the colors and the areas colored in blue are the freshwater components, where essentially there'd be some grading and creation of berms to allow water to retain on the site for a longer period of time before it dries out in the summer to enhance freshwater habitat. And the areas in green colors on the bottom right or southeast corner are the brackish areas that are served by a leaky tide gate. The project would extend the dendritic channels there to allow the tidal water to spread to a larger area. Next slide, please. This is a slide of the parcel. You can see the agricultural parcel. I just threw this in here to see the way that the brackish estuarine area does get connected to Humboldt Bay is through a couple of different culverts with what's now a leaky tide gate that allows some water to leak into the site to create the brackish habitat. Under a separate project in the future, Caltrans has plans to improve the hydrology to expand the brackish marsh habitat that exists in that area. Next slide, please. Slide 6 is a map of the historic situation. Staff believes that the project does constitute filling and dredging for restoration purposes and is as designed will minimize risk to life and property from sea level rise flooding impacts consistent with Coastal Act requirements. Since publication of our report, Commissioner Wilson, as you mentioned, has talked with us and expressed concerns to staff about the proposed wetland restoration project, given that it restores mostly freshwater habitat in an area that you can see was largely tidal. The gray stripes are extent of tidal action before levees were built. The other area in the center top of the photo of the slide are riparian freshwater wetlands that used to exist. In addition to the historic nature of the site is vulnerable to sea level rise. It's projected that by between 2040 and 2050, the outer levees of the wildlife area could be overtopped and cause inundation from overtopping and also from groundwater intrusion into the site. Caltrans is not proposing to restore the site entirely to estuarine habitat, largely for reasons related to the need to provide freshwater mitigation to meet some of their other permit obligations from the Corps of Engineers and the Regional Board for the 101 Corridor project. It also is being done to provide freshwater mitigation for portions of the Bay Trail that will be coming to you. Just to be clear, I should note that the Commission has not required that this parcel be used for mitigation for coastal development purposes. The Commission, when it approved the highway project, approved Spartina removal in Humboldt Bay and considered that sufficient. So your role today is simply reviewing this for consistency with the Coastal Act, just as any other development. I will point out, though, that although it's planned as freshwater restoration, the plan includes provisions that when sea level rise begins to overwhelm the site, either through direct overtopping or saline ground intrusion, that there are no adaptive management measures that are planned to try to keep the saline waters from affecting the site. And so eventually the site will convert naturally with the rise of sea level rise to estuarine habitat. These provisions weren't made clear in the staff report, so the second addendum, includes findings that address that and a condition that would say that that intent not to provide those adaptive management measures to keep out salt water be followed. A benefit of that is that this will greater ensure that there's wetland habitat that will remain viable over the long term. There won't be the need to provide extensive fortifications to try to keep out rising sea level rise or to create drainage diversions to keep out saline groundwater that could compromise the ability that would be difficult to maintain and if not successful would compromise the freshwater wetland while not ensuring that estuarine habitat is successful either. So next slide, please. And so staff is recommending that the commission find that the restoration project is fully consistent with all applicable Chapter 3 policies for the reasons explained in the staff report. Before closing, I do want to point out that in addition to the addendum I mentioned, there was an earlier addendum that reflects a change to the disposal site for the 35,000 cubic yards of material that will be excavated from the site. Caltrans change that, and so that's the purpose for that addendum. So with that, we're recommending that the commission adopt the staff recommendation as revised by both of the addenda and approve the project with conditions. And that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for the report. Are there any ex parte on this item?
I have ex parte.
Mr. Wilson.
Which I'm going to read off my phone because I can't get it onto my laptop here. So basically, I did speak with staff on this, but on 2:11 at 2:30 and 3:30, two phone calls, one first with Desiree Davenport and the second one with Robert Wall, Jeff Pimlin, Pimentel, sorry, was my handwriting, and Brandon Larson, all with Caltrans, to discuss with them this project. I did express my concern that it's in an area that is really has been estuarine in the past, that putting in freshwater wetlands, and so and it will be estuarine in the future. So my concern was, does the topography reflect what it will be under sea level rise conditions? And that we have been putting these kind of requirements on our developments, and are we really doing well to in sort of considering this in when we're doing these freshwater wetlands? I want to add that I in that conversation well, actually, I'll get back to this. That was what the crux of that discussion was, and I'll get into sort of what came out of that later. Comments.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any others? All right, on behalf of the applicant, Caltrans, Mr. Pimentel. How much time do you need?
15 minutes, but I plan to use about maybe 8 to 10 for presentation, then a reserve 5 for comments, rebuttals.
All right, if you can do 8. To 10 for your presentation, that would be greatly appreciated, because okay, we're going to start losing commissioners. So
yeah, perfect. You're going to make me look bad if you take too long.
So. Okay, I will try to get through this
brief
quickly
and cover what you need to cover. Yeah,
perfect.
Thank you.
All right, so this is Eureka Arcata U.S. Route 101 corridor project offsite mitigation. It's before you. Let's see if this is working. As you guys remember, in August, we came in for the CDP for the projects. This is just an overview map, which you've all seen before, for the projects that are being mitigated in terms of the impacts created by those projects. In terms of the share mitigation, as Bob had mentioned, we are providing mitigation for the Humboldt Bay Trails. Nearly half of the mitigation that's dedicated from our efforts here is dedicated to the Humboldt Bay Trails project that Humboldt County and the city of Arcata are taking the lead on. One of those trails already constructed, the final segment coming next year. Our mitigation plan is kind of has a two-pronged approach. The first one, to satisfy our coastal resource impacts, is 180 acres of Spartina eradication. We did attempt to get the Army Corps and the Water Board and our coordination with them to get them to also accept this form of mitigation in terms of the beneficial ecological lift to Humboldt Bay. We were unsuccessful in doing that, and so that's really the reason why we're here today for this offsite mitigation plan at the Samoa sites to offset our impacts under Section 401 and 404 of the Clean Water Act for the Army Corps and the Water Board. Just real briefly, this is an updated map of Indian Island in the city of Eureka, where we plan to do this Spartina eradication. The various shadings there just represent the different percentage of cover classes of Spartina. So we are excited to get underway with that effort, which is in process now in terms of getting our contracts in place to get that work started this year. And now shifting over to the Samoa Offsite West Wetland Restoration Project. These are a couple pictures of the site. The habitat map, which Bob had shared with you earlier, so I won't spend too much time on that. As I mentioned, this is to mitigate our impacts under Section 401, 404 of the Clean Water Act for the Army Corps and the Water Board. We will be establishing 30 acres of palustrine wetlands 15 acres enhancement of Palestrian wetlands as well, and then we'll be restoring 4.75 acres of estuarine tidal mudflat. And then, as Bob mentioned, with the leaky tide gate and the culvert, there's not a whole lot of control we have over simply a piece of infrastructure that's broken and not functioning properly. And for years working on this project, we've been trying to get CDFW to be open to a saline component of the site, and we've consistently hit a challenge with them not being open to that. Well, a few months ago, that changed. There was a change in management that we coordinate with, and they were open to it. And so that was a huge win. And so we were able to, in this phase of the project that's before you, allow that inundation from the leaky tide gate that we don't have control over in terms of the flow that's coming in and out of that broken tide gate. But we are grading it to be able to restore 4.75 acres of the tidal mudflat that I mentioned. But we are in the process of creating a follow-up project that we're calling Phase 2, where we will actually go in and replace the tide gate, replace the culvert, and we plan to actually create or restore 21.3 acres by the time we're done. So about a four-fold increase from what we'll do in this first phase that's before you. And also working with CDFW, they are in agreement, open to the fact that they shall not employ, you know, adaptive management strategies to prevent the natural overtaking of the site with estuarine habitat as sea level rise, you know, occurs over time. So our plan is through the 10-year long-term 10-year monitoring and maintenance period, at the conclusion of that, we would then transfer the property over to CDFW. So it's also important that we're also operating within the bounds of something that they're in agreement with. But I feel like we found a good middle ground. In terms of our schedule, we are currently on the March CTC agenda for our construction funding allocation. And we plan to begin construction this summer in 2020. And that's all I had. So I think I even beat 8 minutes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.
So very, very much. I don't have any other speakers who want to address the commission on this matter. Is there any further comment from staff? Hearing none, we'll bring it back to the commission for discussion and direction.
So, Wilson. First of all, I'll just make the motion to move this forward, but then I'll have just a comment, if that's all right. So I move that the commission approve the coastal development permit 1-19-0813 pursuant to the staff recommendations, and this includes the addendums that have been included that we talked about today. So I just want to put that on the record before we have a... Thanks. The reason I wanted to bring this to the attention of the board is both, I just wanted to illustrate I think that after talking to the staff at Caltrans, I think that they did a good job of addressing what was an interesting situation related to sea level rise, and that they were trying to balance being really squeezed out. And the freshwater wetlands in here are to basically match freshwater wetlands that they're mitigating for, that there's the take. The issue for me, and I think, I mean, which makes to me sort of a little bit of an imperfect project, and I'm okay with imperfect projects, it's all right, is that they really pushed the, is that even in the areas where this freshwater wetland they're mitigating for, it will also be inundated by sea level rise. So really the topography of this entire site, in my opinion, should have been completely done in matching of that. The challenge for them physically on the ground is on the bay side of this project, you have California Fish and Wildlife for years has been managing it as a freshwater wetland for their purposes, even though in that area it's subsided, it's protected by a levee, it won't be a freshwater wetland. It will fail. That effort will eventually fail, and we need to ecologically prepare for that, because the more sinuosity we're putting into our in the more vertical structure we're putting into these systems now are going to be the nurseries and the high level productivity areas of the future that we need to as part of that adaptation, as part of we see these habitats moving inland. I think they did a good job in terms of like trying to balance that with all of these agencies with also Army Corps permit, which is very static. A lot of our laws are based on a static view of the world. They're not currently our environmental laws. A lot of them are not created for this dynamic space. So in this case, it's a bit imperfect, but I think that they did a good job of trying, and they actually really did address that, and I wanted to give them kudos to that, and kudos to Desiree specifically, who was their lead on that. And so with that, I move that we approve this project.
Thank you. It's moved and seconded. Wilson, Brownsey, any further comment or dialogue? Is there any objection to unanimous approval? Hearing none, the findings are adopted. The permit is issued. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, while we're doing a changing of the guard here, I do want to welcome Kate in her new position as Deputy Director for the Energy, Ocean Resources, and Federal Consistency Division, and I'm very, very pleased that she's going to be in this position from now on, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
We are as happy as you are, Dr. Hucklebridge. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Happy to be here. So that brings us to item 11, which is the Deputy Director Report for Energy, Ocean Resources, and Federal Consistency. There are three immaterial amendments for your consideration today. I would like to spend just a few minutes on the First Amendment. This is a request by Cal-Am to allow a test desalination well located in the city of Marina to remain in place for an additional year and to conduct limited maintenance during that period. This test was originally approved by the Commission in 2014. To conduct 2 years of pump tests and included a requirement to remove the well by February of 2018. Cal-Am has completed its pump tests, but prior to the initial removal deadline, requested that the Commission allow the test well to remain in place for an additional year while it completed CEQA and pursued authorization of a desalination facility that would include repurposing the test well for long-term use. The Commission granted that extension through an immaterial amendment in 2017 and then again in 2018. And as Cal-Am is still in the process of seeking approval for a desalination facility, is making the same request a third time. We have received two objections and one comment on this immaterial amendment, which we have included in a correspondence packet for this item. We have also posted a written response to the issues raised in the objections. In brief, the objections raised question whether the Commission has jurisdiction to hear this item and whether this amendment should be considered material due to the potential for adverse effects on coastal resources and nonconformance with the City of Marina LCP. As discussed in more detail in the written response and consistent with previous Commission findings, we believe that this Commission does have jurisdiction over this matter and that the amendment is indeed immaterial in that the one-year extension will cause no adverse effects to coastal resources and is in conformance with the city's LCP. With regard to the other two immaterial amendments, staff has received no comments on these, and we are not aware of any opposition, and we therefore seek your concurrence in approving all three of these items.
Thank you very much. Any ex parte on this? Is there any objection to unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, Commission concurs.
That brings us to item 11. Which is the consent calendar for energy, ocean resources, and federal consistency. As Carl reported earlier, we moved combined items 13A and 14A and also item 13B to the consent calendar. There is a short addendum for item 13B that includes some corrections and minor changes. We're not aware of any opposition to any of these, including the proposed changes in the addendum, and we therefore seek your concurrence and approval on these items under the consent calendar. Sorry.
Thank you. Are there any ex parte with regard to items moved to consent? Is there a motion?
Move consent.
All right. Moved. Brownsey Wilson, any further comment? Any objection to unanimous adoption? Seeing none, the consent calendar is adopted.
Thank you.
Brings us to San Diego.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're now on to item 15, which is the Deputy Director's Report for San Diego Coast District. There are five waivers and an immaterial permit amendment being reported. There have been no public comments in opposition to the waivers, but We're also reporting on an immaterial amendment for the Encinitas Streetscape project that this commission heard on appeal back in October 2018. We originally reported on this amendment in December, but during the 10-day comment period and after the hearing, we did receive a number of objections. The original project approved by the commission involved the reduction of travel lanes on Coast Highway between A Street and La Costa Avenue, installation of bike lanes, bus turnouts, roundabouts, crosswalks, and sidewalks and new parking bays, all of which was designed to improve the pedestrian scale of the area and encourage the use of alternate transit. The proposed amendment expands the number of parking bays, changes some sidewalks into wider DG paths, and includes some additional safety improvements. The objections raise concerns about an increase in pervious surfaces, water quality issues, and flooding, among some other concerns. Staff's detailed responses to the concerns are in a write-up in the Deputy Director's report, but staff concluded that the issues raised are either not an issue under this proposal or the issue raised is fully addressed by special conditions in the underlying permit. So we continue to recommend that this item be approved as an immaterial amendment on the Deputy Director's report. So staff's recommending the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination and approve the Deputy Director's report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swing. Are there any ex parte? I do note for the record there are four speaker slips here on behalf of the City of Encinitas. Appreciate the drive and getting up early and the patience, but they are available for questions only if the Commission desires to take questions on any items. Seeing none, I think you're off the hook. Is there any objection to unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, the Commission concurs.
Thank you. So that takes us now to item 16, which is for applications removed from regular calendar to consent. There are five items. Item 17A, that's the City of Encinitas LCP amendment on emergency shelters, their certification review. Item 17B, this is the City of Encinitas LCP amendment on minor subdivisions and lot line adjustments. Item 17C, City of San Diego's LCP amendment on placemaking. This is the certification review. Application 6, item 19A, which is application 619731 for the City of San Diego's public works project to improve, make some improvements at their Dog Beach area. And then item 20A, which is permit amendment 616406A2. This is for the Lowe's Coronado Bay Resort and California State Parks project in Coronado. So the conditions are acceptable to the applicants. There haven't been any comments in opposition to any of these items. So staff's recommending these items get moved to consent and approved pursuant to the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Swing. Are there any ex parte with respect to any of the items on move to consent? Seeing none, I will note for the record that we do have speaker slips with respect to items 17A, 17B, and 20C on the consent that indicate they are available for questions only if it becomes necessary. Is there any desire to pull any item off that? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Move to approve consent.
Moved by Wilson Groom. Any further comment? Any objection to unanimous adoption? Seeing none, the consent calendar is adopted. And I do believe with the movement of 19B, that would conclude our agenda items for today, Mr. Amesworth. Is that correct? Wonderful. Thank you. Well done, as always. Thanks to everyone for your patience. We will see you on March 11th. We will adjourn to that meeting.